All right. Quite a few brave souls willing to sit through 3 hours of advanced PhD. We're going to get pretty hairy by the end of it. The section on extending PHP, I've tried to dumb it down as far as I can, but in the end, I mean, you need to know what a pointer is, what a double pointer is, what a structure is in C. I mean, there's just some things that can't be dumbed down any further. So if you're really weak on C and have no interest at all in extending PHP via C, then maybe bail at the break, perhaps. And please don't worry about offending me. I mean, my goal here is that if I didn't lose everyone by the end, then I haven't quite done my job. But we're going to start off with slightly easier stuff. The security stuff sort of was meant for the morning tutorial, but I had way too much stuff, so I bumped this to the afternoon. Safe mode is something that you'll run into when you start playing with PHP. You'll see certain scripts say it only works in safe mode, it doesn't work in safe mode, or ISPs, if you have an ISP, and they'll say, well, we have PHP configured to run in safe mode. Safe mode is a really, really crappy thing that I did to solve a dumb problem that shouldn't have been my problem in the first place. But what the problem is that when you have a shared server, so you have a server with multiple virtual hosts, you have a single instance of Apache, basically, and the Apache process runs as a single user ID, typically nobody or web or www or something, but a single user ID, the Unix-level user ID, is what all the Apache processes end up running as. That means that the PHP scripts that run within these processes will also run as that particular user ID. It's fine if you have a single server and you have full control over that server. If you have multiple people and multiple virtual hosts on the server, that means that Joe over here and his virtual host can write a script that does stuff to Bob's files over in this virtual host because they're running as the same user ID, they have the same permissions, they can open and read the same files, there's nothing stopping Joe from screwing up Bob. And now, this really should be solved at the web server level. There should be a way of telling the web server, run this virtual host as this user, run that virtual host as that user, maybe even run them in jails and stuff, so one user cannot see another user's files. There's no real easy way to do that with Apache. My preferred way of doing it is actually something I'll talk about later, is having multiple instances of Apache on your server and running it behind a reverse proxy so that you can run them on separate ports. They all look like they come off of port 80, and that really solves the problem. To me, that's the best way of doing it. A lot of people don't like that because they want to squeeze 50, well, even more than that. I can run 50 instances of Apache pretty easily, but if you want to put 5,000 or 50,000 virtual domains on a single server, yeah, managing 50,000 different installs of Apache can get to be a bit of a headache. It's not that bad if you automate this stuff, but you need a ton of RAM and stuff, and it's not quite as efficient as having just a single one. There are some moves in Apache 2, at least I've been trying to push that for many years now. There's something called the per-child NPM in Apache 2, which forks off a multi-threaded process that can sit and run as a separate user ID, and then at the top level, we can direct the request to the appropriate process that's taking requests for this particular virtual host. So it's sort of built into Apache that you can have multiple users, or you have different users owning the processes that are attached to each virtual host. None of the code works yet, though. It's sort of, in theory, it should work. Code has been written. The code sucks. I was hoping Apache 2 would not get released without this code, because this is sort of the killer feature for Apache 2. Once we fix this and get this working, lots of ISPs would switch completely to Apache 2. As it is, there's really no killer feature in Apache 2. Oh, the features it has is that it's slower and less stable. So if those are attractive features, go ahead, switch. But right now, it's really not a good idea. Yes, and that's typically what ISPs are doing. Typically, ISPs will run PHP as a CGI on their SUExec, and that will work fine, but it means on every request, you're forking and execing a PHP parser. I mean, I started PHP to get away from that. I was writing stuff in Perl, and forking and execing Perl was really dragging down my server. I couldn't really figure out how to embed Perl into NCSA back then, so I built a stripped-down type parser for just the stuff I needed, which became PHP, which I could easily embed inside the server. Now there's mod curl that can be embedded inside, but it has the same problem of running as the same user ID. You don't win there at all. Right now those are the two things. What we have in PHP is sort of a crappy in-between state where, okay, fine. Everything runs as the same user at the web server level. It's the same Unix user. But within PHP, if you turn on safe mode, what we can do is, if we have a script, most ISPs, users will upload things. They'll have an account on the server with their own user ID. They'll upload the script via FTP. They might SSH in or something, but who knows. Somehow they get a file up on the server called script.php. That file will be owned by their user ID. Web server will execute this, pass control to PHP. PHP will look at the owner of the script that's executing and say, hey, this file is owned by user Rasmus. I'm going to pretend that I'm running as user Rasmus. I won't actually switch the user because I can't. I had to be running as root originally to switch, and I can't switch back, and it will be a big mess. I'm just going to pretend. So all file operations within PHP, I will look at the target file of the operation. So if I try to do a read file on etc password, etc password is typically run by root, right? So this is the error that I would get. Safe mode restriction in effect, the script whose user ID is 500, which is me, is not allowed to access etc password owned by UID 0. So that's what safe mode does. It goes in and checks the owner of the script trying to do the operation against the file that it's trying to do the operation on. If they don't match, poof, warning. Yes, there are ways around this. There's a way in the Oracle library, for example, to load a file directly into a database through an SQL query. The Oracle library knows nothing about safe mode for obvious reasons. In MySQL, we have actually fixed that. So in the MySQL library, that you can't do it that way. But if you have Oracle open for users to use, yes, there will be ways around that. And potentially there are other third-party libraries out there where you can make some kind of library call that would then access a file that would go around the safe mode restrictions. I think we have caught most of these things and put in checks on them, but I'm not going to stand here and say that this is going to be 100% effective. It will stop the casual hacker from screwing up other people's files. And it's also important to know that the person has to have an account on your system to begin with. This is not something that provides security against outside hackers. It's to separate users within the same machine from each other. So as long as there's some level of trust of the users on your server, turning on safe mode should be pretty effective. It does put a lot of restrictions on you, though, because, for example, a file that you create, it's not going to, if you create it within a PHP script, so you create a new file and write to it within a PHP script, that file is going to be owned by the web server ID. And then you upload the script that tries to manipulate that file, and you get the warning. Say, hey, you can't open the file that you created yourself. That's pretty annoying. I prefer another way. It's not safe mode, but it's called open basedir, where for every virtual host or for every directory, whatever you want, within the Apache configuration file, you can say, within a virtual host, within the directory, whatever, you can set the open basedir value. Typically, an ISP will set virtual host, and then open basedir will be set to the document root for that virtual host. When you set the open basedir, PHP will check all file access against that base directory, meaning you cannot open up a file outside of the base directory. That, to me, is a more effective way, because that way you can create files, you can upload files, you can do all kinds of stuff. As long as they're inside your own open basedir directory, you're fine. Yes? If they what? A symbolic link. It will do a real path, or whatever it's called, on it. So no, if the symbolic link is to something outside open basedir, it will not work. If it's symbolic link somewhere underneath, it'll try to resolve the symbolic link and see where it goes. So I have to be smart about that. And the other thing that you can do as an ISP, you can also disable certain functions right in the PHP INI file, and this is server-wide. You can't really do it on a per virtual host basis just because of the way that we would have to do it on every request. You can only do it sort of once for the PHP install, but you can disable functions. The typical one, if you are an ISP, you're providing PHP, you probably will want to disable the DL function. The DL can load up a shared library, basically a PHP extension, load it right in, and you can then execute functions via that. If you allow that, that means that anybody out there can write C code, upload a shared library, DL it in, and run whatever C code they want inside your web server. you can write some really nasty C code if you're allowed to link it into your ISP's web server. And yes, I have done some nice, interesting things to get around various restrictions put on me by ISPs, because, hey, great, fine, restrict me all you want, but you're letting me load the shared library right into Apache. Hey. So yeah, that's probably a good idea to do a disable function DL if you are an ISP. That's sort of the extent of the safe mode stuff that we have tried to provide. It's not great, and I'm really hoping once Apache 2 and 8 years become stable, maybe the per-child NPM will be the way to go. Other security-related stuff. Here's a typical one. This is the one that motivated the change for register globals, sort of not sticking stuff in the global symbol table by default, meaning turning register globals on, off. We talked about this morning. Register globals is the setting that tells us whether or not user data is going to end up as direct PHP variables in the global symbol table. If you turn register globals off, user data comes in $_post, get, cookie, whatever other arrays are out there. Now, if register globals is on, and you run a script like this, if user is Rasmus, set OK to true. If OK, echo user logged in. So sort of a casual look, it looks like only if the user variable is set to Rasmus will I be able to log in. Which isn't quite true, because I forgot to initialize my OK flag here. So if I put OK equals 1 in my URL, that will be right in the get method argument. So OK is going to be set to true. I can skip right past this check and still end up in here. So I can change the way my script works based on injecting variables into the script. That caused the whole panic about register globals. To me, I still program everything with register globals on. I hate using the longer format, and I'm pretty confident that I can not make this mistake, especially if you turn off on a higher warning level. Set your warning level to e-all. You're going to get a warning in this script to say, hey, you're using an undefined variable called OK here. If you put OK equals false at the top here, there's no variable that you can inject that would change the operation of the script, because those variables are set before you start executing the script. They will get overwritten by the variable in the script itself. So even if I pass in OK equals true, if at the very top of my script I have OK equals false, it's fine. There's no problem with this script. There's inherently no problem with having register globals on. It is easy to make mistakes if you don't know what you're doing, if you're not used to programming. So if you're running other people's code, yeah, it's probably not a bad idea to turn off register globals if you don't trust the code that you're running. But the basic part of securing any web application, not just PHP, is that you can never, never, ever trust anything coming from the user. Never write code like this. Read file dollar file name, for example. And even if you turn off register globals and you fetch it out of the post variable, it doesn't make it any safer at all. I'll have people tell me, well, I've created a form that has three radio buttons. You can only pick between these three file names, right? And it sends, you do the post and you get one of the three file names. It's got to be secure, because how can you pick another file name? There's not a fourth button, or they can't enter their own. It's coming from the user. You always have to remember that. I've done it many, many times. I was born in Greenland. Typical no forms will have Greenland on there as any sort of option for where you come from, right? So I will take the form, save it to my own server, add Greenland, and post it back to them, right? And there are no checks for that anywhere. And you cannot, just because you've only given them three options in the form, you're sending the form to the user. The user at that point can do whatever they want with it. Just file, save, go in, change the form, post it back. Load it up locally and hit the send button, right? It doesn't take any kind of brilliant hacker to hack a form. So never, never, ever trust user data. If you're going to do something like this, letting the user specify a file name that they want to show on your server, make sure that it's inside the document root, so within files that they could just browse to directly anyway. So figure out where the document root is by checking the server variable document root. Make sure they don't have any dot, dot, slash, dot, dot, slash, dot, dot type of attacks on you. You can do that by calling real path. That will resolve the actual path. You can have a bunch of dot, dots. So they have dot, dot, slash, dot, dot, slash, dot, dot, slash, etc password. This will just end up being etc password at this point. So then you have document root, /etc/password. generally safe, unless you have an ECC password sitting under your document root, then that's perfectly fine. You can also check the extension of things, for example. So if you want to force people to have only load up HTML files, go in and do a quick little check. This picks off the extension without using a regular expression. It searches from the back of the string looking for the first dot that it sees, then does a substring from then on to the end. So that just picks off the extension, and you can check that. You do have to be a little bit careful with this. And we probably need to fix this within PHP, but PHP is binary safe. All strings in PHP are stored as the actual string and then the length, the number of bytes in that string. So if somehow they can get a null into the string, many of the underlying libc functions don't deal with that very well. They'll just do a straight string length. So if they actually had file name null dot jpeg, for example, when you do this check, you will see, hey, it ends with dot jpeg. You pass that to a libc function. The libc function does a straight string length and stops at the null. And all it has is file name. It forgets about the dot jpeg part. So that is one hack that I have seen recently that people have been using. And actually injecting nulls into data to try to get around any kind of extension type checks like that. That, of course, doesn't help them with any sort of check like this, where you force files to only be opened under a certain directory. It doesn't matter if they try to get around the extension check. So be a little careful if you're just relying on extensions, that there are ways to trick the underlying library functions to ignore the extension. Another one, don't do that. System ls dir. System is a PHP function that executes a system call and shows the result. You might think the worst that can happen is that they can look at any directory on your server. They can do more than that. If they put, instead of this dollar dir, or instead of just a directory here, if they put in dot semicolon cat etc password, right, that's going to execute, it'll list the current directory, then it'll show them the etc password file. There's an escape shell arg function that you can apply to an argument saying that this should just be a single argument. So it basically puts quotes around the thing and it gets executed as a single argument. So if you do want to let them list directories but not execute stuff, if you escape shell arg it, then this is okay. True, but chances of you having a file that's called dot semicolon cat space etc. Yeah. Other things. This is a typical one. I always see people think, don't call your include functions dot inc. Something I've been doing for years. Stuff that I didn't want to be parsed directly by PHP. Libraries of functions or snippets of HTML or whatever, I would put them off in .inc files. What people didn't realize was that I also had a block in my Apache server configuration that said, do not allow any direct access to anything ending in .inc. So if you try to load up the file directly by typing in the URL, file.inc, you'll get back a denied from Apache. Now, people wouldn't do that, so they would just put it in and they'd say, hey, I can browse to this file directly and it shows me the source code, because .inc is not a PHP type, so it won't get parsed by PHP, so I'll just show it as a text file. And say, hey, this is horrible. People can look at my source code, so I'm going to name all my PHP include files .php instead. That way they'll get parsed through PHP and people can't see the source code. But then you're executing code out of context. Code that was written to be included inside a certain context is now being executed outside of that context. And maybe through a regular global hack by injecting stuff into it, or maybe just straight by executing the stuff out of context, you can cause this code to do something that was not intended. So to me, it's worse if they can execute this code versus just seeing it. But in my case, they can't do either. They can't execute it. They browse to it directly, it's going to get denied. So there's really no point. And they can't see the code, obviously, either. And the other way to get around this is not to put your include files under your document root. Put them off in an include dir somewhere. You can set PHP's include path, just like a shell path, a command path. You can set directory colon, another directory colon. So when you do include foo.inc, it's going to go look through the include path to see where it can find that file. So you don't have to have them under your document root. File uploads. Obviously, if you allow people to upload files to your server, be very, very careful. If you allow them to just upload whatever they want into your document root, people are going to write a PHP script, upload it, browse through it, boof, they've executed whatever code they want on your server. And there are various other ways to do something like that. A couple years ago, Apache.org, the Apache server's website, got hacked through something like this. What happened was someone decided it'd be a very good idea if we had an FTP upload directory for people to upload patches to the server. There's nothing inherently wrong with that. They had a file size restriction on it and stuff to try to prevent some of the Ware's kiddies from putting stuff in it. But people then upload patches into this directory on the FTP server. Somebody else said, hey, it would be really cool if we could just download these patches directly from the web server. So they did a symlink to that FTP upload directory so you can upload files via FTP, and then you can browse directly to them via the web. PHP was enabled on the server. So obviously someone FTP uploaded a PHP file, browsed to it with the web browser, and they could then execute whatever code they wanted through PHP. That was deemed to be my fault somehow. Which I do not. I don't think it was my fault at all. It's just two people who configured. Each of them didn't really do anything wrong. The guy who enabled file uploads in the FTP server, that's fine by itself. The guy who then made that directory available via Apache is a little bit more questionable, but in reality, there's really nothing wrong with that. What he should have done is made sure that he couldn't execute CGIs or PHP files in that particular directory. But my punishment for having done this, which I didn't do either of these steps, was that I had to field all the reporters' questions. Why is Apache an unsafe server? How did the Apache web server get hacked? And it's very difficult to explain to non-technical people that this had absolutely nothing to do with Apache, really. It didn't have anything to do with FTP or PHP. It was just too many administrators not really understanding the configuration. But I had about a week of that. Every other day I would get calls from reporters. It was a bit annoying. So if you allow people to upload files, be very careful what type of files you accept and where you put these files. If you don't put them under your document root, you should be fine, assuming you don't allow the user to specify the path. I mean, don't overwrite your etc password, for example. Generally, file-level permissions will not let the web server overwrite etc password. They can read it, but not write it. But still, there could be writable files out there. Even like Apache log files and other things that the Apache server is allowed to write to, if an attacker can specify the file path where something gets saved, he can replace log files to hide his tracks. He might even be able to replace permission files for MySQL servers or other things like that. So be very careful what type of data you get, where you put it. To actually do a file upload, you have a form that looks something like this, multi-part form data, an action script, the action that actually takes the file and does something with it. So you end up getting a file. There's a thing called move uploaded file. It's a PHP function that does a safe move. It makes sure that the file that we're moving is actually an uploaded file, because there have been ways of attacking the file upload feature where you specify a false source file and the false target, so you're actually copying a file within the web server. It has nothing to do with the file that you uploaded, but you're now tricking the receiving script into copying a file to a different place. And that's a bad thing. So if you use the move uploaded file, it makes sure that the file you're moving around is actually an uploaded file. And be very careful about how you figure out where to put these things as well. Come up with a good destination, hopefully outside of your document root. You can do various checks on it. If you're uploading pictures for an image, album, photo album, you can call get image size. Get image size will actually, it doesn't look at the extension, it goes right into the data of the file itself and tries to figure out what format is this file in. And it'll come back and it'll tell you if it's a GIF, a JPEG, a PNG, or a flash animation, or what that file is. So you can do that type of check to see this is actually an image, and then you can also ensure that it's saved with the right type of extension. So here I go through, I figure out the type. So even if they have, say they have a PNG image with a GIF file name, I'm not quite sure how that could be a security problem, but here that goes through and puts the right extension back on that file. All right, that's sort of all I really have to say about security things. It's mostly really, really obvious stuff, and it boils down to not trusting what's coming in at any point, always checking and being intelligent about where you save files and how you manipulate files on your server. Yes? No, there's no taint node in PHP. I have looked at adding a taint node in the past. It gets really, really bloody complex. of how to, even within Perl, it's not very well defined how taint mode actually works. And you end up having people that just have good little tricks for untainting stuff. They'll untaint it, hey, great, now I can use this stuff, and then they pass it around everywhere, and it ends up not being very effective. And it would be nice, if, for those of you who don't know what taint mode is a way of specifying that the variable has been tainted. And until you clean it, you pass it through a filter to actually make it a good variable that you can now use, you're not allowed to use it for certain things. You're not allowed to use it in system calls and then other things like that. The problem with PHP, and Perl has the same issue, is that different things are tainted in different ways depending on what they're going to be used for. A variable that gets used in an Oracle query has a lot, a whole different set of problems than a variable that's going to be used in a shell argument or in a MySQL query or in an LDAP query or any of these things. And I looked at the problem and figured, well, how the heck am I going to build a taint mode that's going to understand all these back ends? I have to have some kind of filter hook where every back end has to register the type of stuff that causes this thing to be tainted. And the problem just seemed way too big. Maybe sometime in the future we can see. Yeah? Yeah, but to me that's not useful. To me that's not enough. I want to be able to, the whole point of PHP is to make this stuff simple. And if we make it simple, it's got to be right. And to me, if I provided a taint mode and then they just had some, people look up in the manual, how do we untaint? And you give them a certain rule, here's how you untaint. Well, that untaint rule is very specific to a certain thing. I guess if we provided a big library saying, okay, for this version of Oracle, here's untaint. For this version of Oracle, if you upgrade Oracle, remember to go back and change your untaint rules. If you upgrade this, if you're talking to that, if you pass the same piece of data to many different things, well, how are these untaint functions going to interoperate? How are they going to filter? Are they even going to interoperate? Maybe they clash and you can't use them. So to me, it's just, well, damn it, let's not try to solve that problem. Let's just educate users and say, okay, make sure. You never, ever trust this stuff. So by default, everything is tainted, basically, in PHP. We just don't have a little hook that says, error, sorry, you didn't untaint it yet. But yeah, I do agree that it would be cool to have an untaint mode. I just haven't found a good implementation yet. Yes? No, that's not usually stored in a CVS file. All you have is repository root and entries. Right. If you mean if you have a if you have a conflict, you have a hash. Okay. But I thought you meant inside the CVS directory. Inside the CVS directory, there's nothing useful. But yes. And also the other typical thing people have is that they leave the backup files on in their editors. Many websites you go to, if you put a tilde after HTML. filename.html tilde, you can see the actual, or not .html because that'll show, but .php tilde, .pl tilde, whatever, you can see the source code for the thing because the tilde on the back of it. So yeah, you want to turn that off in your editor as well if you're editing right in your document root. Are there security related questions? The question is, he has a PHP file on his server that connects to his MySQL database. Is there anything, because in PHP you can do a remote include. You can do include HTTP and load a file off of a server. What you're not thinking about is that the request that comes across to include your file is a normal HTTP request. It's going to hit your server. Your server is going to get a normal HTTP request. It's going to parse this file through PHP and just send the result to that remote server. So the guy who included it is only going to get what your PHP script generates. He's not going to get your include file source code. So he doesn't get jack shit, basically. He just gets the output saying, okay, connected to MySQL, whatever your script does, basically, right? He doesn't get the actual code. So yeah, that wouldn't work for him at all.
He wouldn't get the
password. No, because the password is used within the script to actually connect to the server, right? So if you browse to that script and do a view source in your browser, you don't see PHP source code, right? Because it gets parsed before it gets sent. And this is a .php file, so it cannot leave the server without getting parsed by PHP. So unless you leave the server password in an HTML comment outside of PHP, then you're fine. Others? Yes. Yes. See, if you have multiple people on the same server and each has different passwords to the MySQL database, yes, you need something like OpenBaser or SafeMode or CGI version, the SUExec. You need something to prevent them from doing this. I mean, persistent connections as well. You don't even need the person's, well, you sort of do for the next persistent connection. But there are some other ways of hacking around it. If you're really security conscious, yes, you don't share a server with somebody. You have your own server. You're not going to run any kind of large e-commerce site on a shared virtual host. You want to have your own machine for this stuff. It's getting pretty cheap these days to actually have your own hosted server somewhere. I ran stuff for a while under a bunch of VMware slices, so every user got their own operating system on my machine. It worked pretty well. Yeah. Yeah, that's, yeah. You can. It's a little flaky, but you can use user mode Linux for that. All right. Let's talk a little bit about HTTP itself. It's sort of a given that we all understand HTTP, but not too many people actually sort of look into the guts of it and what you can do and what it means, the various things. There are 7 basic HTTP requests. Get, put, post, delete, head, options, and trace. Out of these, you've probably seen get and post, maybe head. Get is what you normally, when you type in a URL, hit return, it sends a get request to the server. If you have a form, it's a post method form, and you hit submit, it sends a post request with the associated form data. Caches and things will send a head request to check just the headers for a certain page, seeing has it been modified. Check other things as well. I often do it just to check whether a certain server is running, see if they're running PHP or not. So those are the typical ones. So a head request will not return the body, it will only return the set of headers for a particular response. Put is a way of uploading files. Normal file uploads are done via post, but you can also, some content editors, some authoring tools will do a put request. You have to have a special put handler on your server to get these. Moddav uses put as well. Dav is distributed authoring and versioning. It's a sort of a content management protocol. Options is a way of checking what kind of things the server supports. Not too many web servers actually return anything useful for that. And trace is another way of tracing how a request is handled by the web server. Few web servers support that as well. So all we're really concerned with is get, post, and head to a minor extent. A typical request will consist of the actual get, post, request, whatever the directive is here, the 7 different ones, the thing it's trying to request, and the protocol version. It'll also get various other headers associated. So a browser will typically say, these are the types of images I support. This is the these are the character sets. This is a Mozilla connection that says I support compressed data, except encoding GZIP. That means that you can send back GZIP compressed HTML and the browser will automatically decompress it on the fly. Lots of sites do that. Yahoo, for example, where I work, we compress everything going out. Just saves on bandwidth. Accept language, that's the language that the browser wants to have. When you go into your preferences in your web browser, you can set the language that you prefer. I wish more people would do that, so you don't have to have the stupid little things at the front of the web page say, I want the French version, the English version, the Japanese version. If people just set their language preference, they could get it automatically. Because it's very easy to pick this out and say, okay, he set his browser to English, give him the English version. But people who write websites don't do it because the users aren't smart enough to set their language of choice. It should be an installation option or something, so it gets right in their faces when they're installing the browser, but it isn't. This is the browser saying I support keep alive connections. Keep alive connections are a way to sort of pipeline multiple connections or multiple requests and responses across the same socket connection, so you don't have to tear down the socket and bring it back up again between requests. And then the browser will say, I'm looking for local host. This is to help virtual servers figure out which server they actually want when you have many servers on the same IP. And then finally, the browser will identify itself, saying, I am this type of browser. Usually they'll lie. IE always says Mozilla something, but then it says MSIE in brackets over here, because initially in the early days, a lot of sites were just built for from Netscape, basically, and IE wanted to make sure they worked on those sites, so they pretended to be Netscape with a little comment saying, hey, we're actually IE. And it's still around. Even now, they say that. Right, so in a typical response to this request, first thing you'll notice is that the response is not in the same protocol version as the request. There's absolutely nothing in the spec that says the response has to be the same version as the request. Typically, it won't be. Typically, requests are in 1.0, responses are in 1.1. Lately, the later versions of browsers are now sending 1.1 requests. Another thing comes back is the current time and date on the server, a server string that identifies the type of software running on the server, often the last modified timestamp. PHP will not by default generate these because we don't really know when the content was last modified. It could be coming from many different backend sources. An etag, another caching related header that says that as long as the etag stays the same, the content's going to stay the same, so it's not timestamp dependent. It makes caching a little bit easier. Apache will come back and say, for static pages anyway, that accept byte ranges. Byte ranges are ways to the client can send a request and says, I only want bytes 500 through 1500 of this particular page. Adobe Acrobat Reader uses that a lot. If you load up a big PDF document and zoom right to page 500, it's not going to have to download 499 pages. They're going to send a new HTTP request that says, just give me from here on. And you can zoom right around in the document like that. And it's pretty handy. There are various other things out there that use byte range requests. Content length, how many bytes are in the body of the response. And then this is a response to the fact that the client asked for a keep alive connection. Server comes back and says, okay, here's a keep alive connection. You have 15 seconds between requests. So we will serve up the current request, give you the answer, then we're going to hold the connection open, the socket open for 15 seconds, and wait for you to send another request on that same connection. If you haven't sent one, we'll shut you down. Max 100 means that you can send a max of 100 requests across that socket. Once you send your 100s, we're going to shut down the socket on you. It's especially useful for pages that have lots of images on them. Photo album, again, that has 100 thumbnails, for example. It sucks to have to open up 100 different socket connections between the client and the server. This way, you can just open up a couple and stream lots of images across the same connection. It also means, though, that if you have a server that gets hit a lot, and you have the keep alive timeout set to 15 seconds, it means that every server out there is going to hang around for 15 seconds before it gets ready again to accept new requests. For very busy servers, it might not be a bad idea to lower that a bit. 15 is the Apache default. I generally lower mine to 5 seconds or less so that I don't have servers sitting around just idling doing nothing. And right in the Apache configuration file, you'll see a max keep alive timeout 15. Lower that a bit. It's too high. And finally, a content type of the actual response data that's coming back. So that's basically HTTP. Now, a little bit more on the keep alive stuff when you combine it with PHP. The only way keep alive works is based on the content length that comes back in the actual response. So imagine the client sends a request across the socket. The first one that sets up the keep alive connection, they get 20 bytes back. Content length, 20 bytes. The browser reads the 20 bytes, and after it got the 20th byte, the browser knows it's done. So those little progress bar and stuff is 100% done. Now it'll send the next request. The content type, content length comes back and says 120 bytes. It'll read 120 bytes. Next request, 60. Now if it gets a response back without a content length, which is quite possible, then the browser has no idea how many bytes to read. And that's when you'll typically see something that says connection close in the actual response header. You've probably seen that if you telnet to port 80 on the server, issue a request, and you don't put in a connection keep alive thing in it, it comes back and gives you the response or connection close and then the body of the response. That basically means that the browser is supposed to close its connections, should keep reading until the socket is closed by the server. So that's what happens in the case where you send back a response without a content length header, is that you cannot get a keep alive connection. It's going to come back in that response and say, no, you're done reading this particular body of the response once I close the connection. So the browser will sit there, keep reading and reading and reading until the server closes the connection. So sometimes you end up having this browser and the server not quite understanding each other and getting a little bit confused. Sometimes you go to a web page and it'll just go and just keep sitting there waiting for more data. That typically happens when there's something like a mixed up between the two and the browser is waiting for the server to close the connection. The server is in keep alive mode or something. It keeps the connection open, and then that happens. You can get around this with PHP, because typically in PHP, by the time you send out the headers, you don't know how much data is in the body of your response. You don't know how much data a request to the database is going to generate beforehand. So by the time you send your headers, you can't send a content link, so typically PHP requests will come back without a content link, which means you cannot do keep alive with PHP. You can cache this stuff. There's something called OB start, output buffering start. That basically says all output from now on is going to go into a memory buffer. Then you can generate whatever output you want. At some point, when you're done generating output, you can get the length of your buffer, send out content length, and then send out the content of the buffer. Typically, what you gain here from having the ability to do keep alive is not really worth it in terms of the memory it takes to store this stuff in the buffer and then flushing it afterwards. So I typically would not recommend that you do everything this way. But this is a way of having your PHP scripts being available via keep alive connection. All right, a little bit on references. References are not pointers, damn it. PHP does not have any pointers. These things are not memory addresses like pointers in C are. But PHP does have references. The best explanation I have for a reference in PHP is like a symbol table alias. So say you have this code, $foo equals hello, $bar equals world. Graphically, it looks like this. You have a symbol table alias or a symbol table entry called $foo that references a piece of memory that contains the string hello. You have another symbol table entry called bar, references a piece of memory called world. Now, if the next line in your script is $bar equals the reference to $foo, that basically means that we're creating a symbol table alias, $bar. We already had one, but it doesn't matter. Creating a new one that overwrites the old one that now has a reference to the same piece of memory that $foo is referencing. So it's a symbol table alias that completely peer. It's completely at the same level as $foo. There's nothing about $foo being sort of the primary and this is secondary. They're completely equal. And what happens is that the reference count on this piece of memory has now gone to 2. The reference count on the world bit of memory here has gone to 0, so that gets returned back to the system at that point. And that's how we do memory management in PHP. And it works with anything. Open files, $fp equals f open something. If you later on set fp equal to another one, then that first file will get closed. If you set fp equals null, then the initial file is going to get closed because the reference count has dropped on that one. References can be used to sort of explain how other things in PHP works. We talked this morning about passing arguments by reference into functions. If we explain this in terms of actual references and reference counts and stuff, what happens is that in our function declaration, say, $b, this $b parameter is going to be passed by reference. So what happens here is we have $a equals 1. So we have a simple table entry called $a, points to a piece of memory, or sorry, references a piece of memory containing the number 1. Then we call the function int a. What happens here is that we create a second variable, create a second variable in the symbol table called $b that references that same piece of memory. So this is now a locally scoped variable within the function that references the same piece of memory as $a out in the global scope. So right now the reference count is 2 on this bit of memory here. We do $b++. Since it references the same piece of memory as $a, it has now incremented that. And then after the function, when we echo $a, we get 2 now. The reference count has dropped back down to 1 outside the scope of the function. And that's sort of in terms of references, how passing by reference works in PHP. You can also return references from functions. The syntax is pretty ugly. Function, reference, get data. And then at call time, you have the option of whether you want to use the reference or not. It's usually not a good idea. Sort of surprisingly, references are slower than passing by value in PHP. I know that doesn't make much sense because you look at it and say, well, it must be faster to pass just the reference versus passing a copy of things in. But in PHP, we do copy on write, which means if you're not planning on changing the data, we don't actually make the copy of the data until you try to change the data. So if you're just passing it in and it's a read-only type thing you're passing in, even if it's huge, pass it in by value, you're much better off because everything in PHP is geared towards pass by value things. When we have to separate off the reference, it actually is a bit more gear involved. Obviously, if you're changing it and you want to change the original one, you have to pass it in by reference. But generally, just to save on memory and stuff, don't go with references. All right. Variable variables. This is one of the things that I thought was so obvious that a lot of people get confused about. If $var equals foo and foo equals bar, then obviously $$var equals bar. Right? We'll read that again. $var equals foo. And if $foo equals bar, then $$var is equal to bar. And that happens because if we sort of read it right to left, $var is what? $var is foo, right? What you're left over with now is $foo, while $foo equals bar. So when you just say echo $$var in this case, you get bar. There's no limit to the number of dollar signs you can put in front of variables in PHP. There's a huge limit to what you can comprehend when you start putting dollar signs in front of it. It gets hairy really fast. I would not recommend going beyond two. There are times when it's useful. For example, I've written configuration file parsers where my syntax of my configuration file looked like this, foo equals bar, abc equals 1, 2, 3. And you sort of loop through, read one line at a time, you split the line on the equal sign, and what you end up with here is foo in this variable, bar in this variable for this first line in the configuration file. So $name is going to be foo, $val equals bar. And then you can do a $$name equals val. Trim just gets rid of white space on both ends. So basically $name equals val. So you end up with, since $name was foo, you have now created $foo equals bar. So you're basically generating whatever's on the left side of the equal sign become variables within your script at that point. Then you don't have to write a configuration file parser that parses on certain keywords and stuff. It's just generic. There are a few times when it's interesting to be able to create dynamic variables like that. You can also sort of compose them out of static bits and dynamic bits. So you can do a curvy brackets and then the actual stuff that you want to compose your variable out of, a static part and a dynamic part. You can also have variable function calls. So in this case, string is var, so it's going to be calling a function named var in this case. Or you can compose the thing out of a static string and a dynamic string and call a function that way. There are times in the abstraction layers and other places where it's useful that you can put in almost like function pointers in C, dynamic function names in PHP. All right, a little trick here. Cookie expiry stuff sucks. You really cannot set an expiry time on a cookie and expect it to work. Lots and lots of people ask me about this, and they keep saying, well, I've set this cookie to expire in 30 minutes, and some of my users say that it never works. And other users, well, it expires right away, or other times, it never gets expired, it always works. It's not working, why not? It's important to understand that cookie expiries are handled by the client. You set an absolute date and time that the cookie shouldn't expire. Even if you do stuff in PHP where you just add an hour to the time, for example, say now plus an hour, that gets translated down to an absolute time. So I say something should expire 1 hour from now, it comes back and says, well, it's going to expire January 22nd, 2003 at 4 p.m. If the client's machine has lost its CMOS battery, for example, every time they boot it, it's 1980, that means that this thing is going to expire in 23 years or whatever it is. Right? Yes. Well, it's supposed to all go in PST and stuff. There's supposed to be tricks around that. But yes, I mean, just daylight savings time. Many people don't change their clocks on there, or the Windows is not doing the right thing. But often it's the fact that the CMOS battery just doesn't work. The system clock is slower or faster, or they're off by a couple of years or 20 years sometimes. And setting a cookie that's supposed to expire in 30 minutes and having lived for 23 years doesn't really go well. So you really cannot rely on the fact that the client browsers have the right time. And this fix is so simple. Encode the server's time in the cookie, right? Do something like this. So in your actual set cookie, you come up with the name of your cookie, and then in the value, encode the expiry time. Say I want to expire in 1 hour. Current server time plus 3600 seconds, colon, the actual variable. You can put whatever delimiter you want in here. But in the actual value of the cookie, just encode when this thing should time out. Then when you get it back, you can set whatever expiry you want. In this case, it's a session cookie. You could put an expiry time in 2010 if you wanted to. Who cares? When you get the cookie back, then you decide whether or not you should use it. You check the timestamp that's encoded inside the cookie. If it's not expired, fine. If it is expired, clear it. Be nice to the end user, get rid of the cookie for them. And that gets around any sort of time conflicts because now you're comparing your server's time against your server's time, and that should be relatively consistent. If it's not, you have other problems. All right, some optimization hints. Don't use a regular expression if you don't have to. Regular expressions are very fast, they're very nice. They're not quite as fast in PHP as they are in Perl. We're using the PCRE library that has a Perl-like regular expressions, but there's some really nasty code that's gone in Perl to make regular expressions really, really fast. And they have to do that because regular expressions are used for everything in Perl. In PHP, we have a bunch of string functions, and Perl does as well, but nobody uses them to get around using regular expressions. I mean, don't use a regular expression to change one character into another character, for example. It makes absolutely no sense. There's a string replace function in PHP that takes static strings and changes them to other static strings. So if it's always the same thing, you're converting to something else, use string replace. I had the example earlier of picking off the extension. Many people will use a regular expression to pick off the extension of a file name. It's much faster just to call the two, string rpos and substring, to pick off the extension in an actual file name. We talked about the references earlier. I mean, if you are passing large data structs around and you're modifying them, yes, use references. Instead of passing it in, modifying it, and passing the modified one back out, so you're copying the stuff all around, pass it in by reference if you're going to modify this data inside. Persistent database connections can speed things up. If you're always connecting to the same database with the same credentials and your application gets hit a lot, there's no reason to shut down the connection to the database and bring it back up. Use the pconnect variety of the database connection function. MySQL pconnect, there's a Postgres pconnect, Oracle pconnect. If you're using MySQL, there's a handy function called MySQL unbuffered query. Typically with MySQL, when you send off a query to it, it's going to sit and chew on the query, so it's going to block on the MySQL query call. It blocks on that, sits and chews on the query, spits you back the result. And what happens is that the entire result set is going to get copied into your memory space. You don't really see it yet. You call the various MySQL fetch array and fetch row and things to get the data, but you're getting the data from within your own memory space. You're just sort of moving it around within memory. The server is done with you. It's giving you all the information. It's now your turn to play with stuff. With MySQL unbuffered query, you sort of put it on the server to say, okay, here you go, work on this query. MySQL unbuffered query doesn't block at all. The function call comes right back. It's only when you start fetching rows out that you start blocking. So you have the server sitting and working on the query. When you get around to it, you say, okay, give me the first row back, right? The first call to MySQL fetch row is going to block, sitting there waiting for the server to have the first row fall out of the result. And you can then loop through and get the rows, and as the database server finds these rows from the database, they're made available to you. And you'd never transfer the entire data set across to the client application in that case. So the memory usage on the client process is much lower. The server process uses a lot more memory, but it tends to be the same memory that gets used over and over again, as opposed to having many, many copies for each individual Apache process having the entire result set there. So if you have huge MySQL result sets, it's a very good idea to look at MySQL unbuffered query. It speeds things up a lot and uses a lot less memory. Then again, you probably shouldn't have huge, massive result sets. There's a limit clause in MySQL and Postgres that you can use to say, only give me the first 10 rows, because you're not going to write a web page that shows 100,000 rows anyway. No one's going to sit through downloading all that stuff, usually. Questions so far? No? On my final little point on optimization, don't over-architect things. If it seems complex, it's probably wrong. I don't know how many times I have seen the most amazingly huge and complex architectures on whiteboards, and you look at it and go, no, it's just not going to work. You're never going to finish. I'll hack up the thing that actually will work while you guys are discussing this complex architecture, and guess which version is going to get implemented and run. Because mine will be done by the deadline. You guys won't even be anywhere close. So usually the simple solution really is the best, because you can build it, you can understand it, you can maintain it. Don't build huge, huge castles that I'm just going to fall down on you, but that's getting way too philosophical. All right, another thing people don't usually think too much about is connection handling. When you send a request and start sending back the response, what happens if the user shuts off his computer right in the middle of receiving the response? You have a script sitting there generating the response. Does it keep running? Does it keep trying to send stuff to the socket that has gone away? By default, PHP will abort when it notices that the socket has gone away. So it tries to write stuff, and it sees, hey, I can't write anymore, the script will terminate at that point. If your script does not write anything, then it cannot detect that the connection is down, so it will keep running. You can change this behavior. There is an ignore user abort thing. So if you set ignore user abort to true, PHP will not terminate when it sees that there's nobody receiving the data that you're writing. A script can also get aborted by a time limit. By default, you have 30 CPU seconds to finish your stuff. Otherwise, the script will get killed. You can change that, of course, as well by set time limit or in the PHP INI file. There's also a connection status, and there's a what's called a register shutdown function. You can register at the top of your script a shutdown function. This is a function that's going to get called when your script terminates for whatever reason. Either it finished normally, it was aborted because the user went away or timed out. Within this function, you can then check the connection status by calling connection status and just ending and checking the bits. You can see why the actual script was terminated. So you can do certain things. If at the bottom of your script, for example, you have a very important MySQL query that you have to have always execute, even though the user might have gone away in the middle, you might want to do it either set ignore user abort to true or register a shutdown function. That gets run regardless. Even if the main script aborts in the middle, it will still run the shutdown function at the end. Usually you don't have to worry too much about that, but there are times when it's nice to know how that actually works. Yeah, I mean, PHP will automatically clean up any open resources, any open files, any open database handles, anything like that will get cleaned up. But yeah, if there's some kind of business logic level cleanup that you need to do, then yes, that would be a good place to put it. Don't just put it at the bottom of your script and hope that it always gets there, because maybe people can hack your site by at a very precise time they can turn off their computer, right, or pull their Ethernet cable at a certain time, then they come back in and somehow things are out of whack. So yeah, think a little bit about that. Questions. All right. So a little bit, we talked about connecting to MySQL this morning, a little bit about optimizing, dealing with MySQL. There's MySQL unbuffered query, of course, but also when you have an application that's running too slow, I have gone into so many places where they've been coming up with all kinds of weird ways of optimizing their application. Then you look at their queries and you look at, well, most of your queries are non-indexed. You don't have the index on the right damn column in your database. You go in, you add an index on the right column, and suddenly everything's 100 times faster. And they think I'm brilliant. Like, no, this is straight database stuff. And I'm not a big database guy, but I'm smart enough to go in and be able to turn on logging in their MySQL server and say, hey, give me a log of all the slow queries that's happening on this server. Then you go through and you see, you look at the log of the slow queries, you go through, okay, that query is slow, that query is slow, that query has been run 800 times in the last 3 seconds, and it's non-indexed. Let's index this sucker. So it's not a slow query anymore. And in MySQL, at least, there's a very easy way. You can start up -- log slow queries and also log long format to get a bit more information out of it. In the my.conf file, there's a my.cnf file. You can just put those things in. I'll show you mine. So I have a my.conf file that looks like this. That just sets various things. And it has log long format and log slow queries right in the MySQL D section there. And what that does, it lets me use the MySQL dump slow system call. So here I have a couple of MySQL queries that I do on this slide. I do one that's non-indexed, select star from users where timestamp is greater than 0. Timestamp is not an index column in this particular database. And I do another one that is indexed, select star from users where ID equals Rasmus. The ID is my index on this particular table. So what happens when you look at the output, and there's some other queries from this morning's presentation in here. But if we look through, we will see, what is the query? Well, TS is greater than 0. Is it not in there? Oh. Greater than N? Oh, they don't put the actual, okay. This is actually the query. I'm not quite sure why it says N, not 0. I guess they just mean it's a number here. So they're saying that this query has been executed 3 times, and this is one of the slow queries. But you can also see there are a couple of other slow queries. There's a select star from users, select star from comments. These are queries that are going to do full table scans, because there's no where clause that limits the scope of the query. So it scans through the entire thing, and these things are slow. So if you go through and you sort of systematically eliminate the ones, especially ones with a high count, the queries that happen a lot, you can look at the actual query and then go and find the code where you do this and try to come up with something better. Either change the query or add another index. You don't want to add an index on every single column. That defeats the whole purpose of indices. But this is a very handy tool, at least for MySQL, to go through. For other databases, there are other ways of logging queries. You can just sort of manually go through and look at the queries and see. That tends to be the first place you want to look at the database-driven application if you want to optimize it. Make sure your queries are sane. You have the right indices in the right places. Questions on that? No? All right. This has nothing to do with optimization. This is just cool. There's a UDF version of PHP now. UDF stands for user-defined functions. You can go and you compile this UDF version of PHP. You get this myphp.so, stands for MySQL PHP. You get a shared library, and you can load that into MySQL with a query. Create function PHP, return string so name myphp.so. So you do that. You run MySQL right in the same directory as myphp.so. You run that query, and you've loaded the PHP interpreter into MySQL. It's now sitting in the MySQL engine. Now, within MySQL, you can now do something like select PHP, hello world. This is just a function that echoes stuff back. You can also call functions within PHP. So string ftime is a PHP function. You can get nastier. You can do create table. What we've done here is now we're calling a PHP function on the actual first value that we're inserting here. So on argv1, we're then applying a function and putting it in. The string length gets inserted in the second column here when we do the select. And this is really nasty. Here we can actually put PHP code in the database, and then we can select the PHP code from the database and apply it on the select. So here we have inserted some code into MySQL. The code we've inserted, we call it capitalize, and it's string to upper on the first argument. So this is a PHP function called string to upper. The name of it is capitalized. So now we do select PHP code from test where code name equals capitalized. So test has our iguana, turtle, and atwork, and that goes through and it capitalizes the thing. So it's, I'm not going to say this is very useful at this point. It's getting there, though, because you can imagine using, for example, remember the image function from this morning where you can go through pixel by pixel in an image and look at what the image is? This would actually make it perhaps useful to store images in the database. To me, I've never really seen the point of storing entire images in the database because you can't do select star from images where image contains a red car, right? But with this type of code in there, you can scan the damn image and you can go and see, okay, do we have the set of pixels that enough of them are red and are arranged in a fashion that might look like they are a car? And then return all the images. Or just like a porn scan, give me all the images with enough skin tone colors, right? Yes? No. Postgres doesn't have a nice clean API for doing that. It's the API level stuff. It's not a real, yeah, we have looked at it a little bit. Nobody has been keen enough on it to sit down and do it. It's not that Postgres can't do it. We haven't done it for Postgres. And it's, we probably will at some point. If you want to do it, great, do it. I'm not convinced that it's super useful anyway. It's sort of, I get a little worried when I start putting my PHP code right into my database. All right, let's talk a little bit about installation. It shouldn't really be an advanced concept, but it turns out that it generally tends to be. It tends to be a little bit hard to get sort of anything but a non-standard PHP build up and running right. Here's sort of the typical approach. If you want PDF support, I showed the PDF generation this morning. I'll show more stuff on Friday on that. First, you need the client library. We use a thing called PDFlib. We have a couple other libraries we can also use, but this is the one that's most complete. And the guys in Germany, it's not a completely open source library, which is the only big drawback. If you're using it for commercial uses, you have to get a license. It's like 400 Deutschmarks, like $700 Australian or something for a site license or something. Yes? Yeah, there are a bunch of classes. There's stuff written in PHP. There's another one called clib-pdf. There are ways of doing PDF without using any sort of commercial software. They're not very complete. They're not very fast. PDFlib is a very, very complete library. If you're going to do serious PDF stuff, I'm not a GPL guy at all, by the way, and I'm not that against small companies making a few bucks off of commercial sites. And they're very nice about it. I mean, they maintain all the documentation in PHP on it. They maintain a very up-to-date PHP extension. You get all the source code for the thing. It's not like it's a closed source library. You get a full tarball of all the source code. If you're using any sort of non-commercial thing, you're fine. Educational talks, whatever, what non-commercial websites, you can use it for whatever you want. Only for commercial stuff, they charge it. And I don't have a problem with that. But yes, if you do, there are other ways of doing PDF and PHP where it's non-commercial. So anyway, you grab the library, you untar it, CD into it, configure, make install. It's not just PDF lib, it's just about any library out there. If you don't have a nice package for your operating system that can install this stuff, configure, make, install, you get the third-party library thing installed first. Then you have to worry about getting the PDF part of it into PHP. Now, PHP holds the world record, I think, for the most autocomp switches. We have tons. We really do. So here's like a configure minus minus help from a little while ago. Oops. I went to the next slide. One second. So here it is here. Now, there's a lot of different switches on this thing. Now, I wasn't kidding. I mean, I do think we hold the world record. There might be something else out there that has more, but we're definitely up there. So basically, you read through that, and you find the bit that says PDF. Let's find PDF. That's the wrong one. So here's one here that says, with PDF lib equals dir. The equals dir part is usually optional. We will look in the standard places. If you just do a configure make make install, it's going to install it in the standard location on your server. You can just do configure minus minus with PDF lib. And when you build PHP, it will now build in support for PDF. If you're adding PHP support to an already existing PHP build, you don't want to recompile PHP, you can do minus minus with PDF lib equals shared. That will build a shared library version of it. You'll see modules in the directory called modules, pdflib.so. I think that's pdf.so. You can then copy that into your extension directory and enable it in your PHP INI file. Not that hard to do. Typically, if you're building PHP from source, you will want to pick the type of Apache module, either Apache 1 or Apache 2. Apache 1 is just with APXS. For Apache 2, minus minus with APXS 2 equals the path to APXS program. APXS is this Apache supplied program that specifies the configuration and location of files within Apache. And then also whatever other switches you need with PDF lib might go on here with MySQL, whatever. Some typical configure flags. This is what I use to build my particular one here on my laptop. So PDF lib, GD, free type, JPEG, PNG, XPM, EXIF, all kinds of stuff is on here. This is why PHP support for Apache 2 is a real hassle. Making sure that all these libraries are thread safe is not easy. A lot of these libraries on Unix are not thread safe. It's going to take a while before sort of the entire Unix world learns how to write thread safe reentrant code. A lot of it just isn't. On Windows, most of it is because it's always been threaded. On Unix, we're not there. So, so you can build it as a static module as well. When you build PHP as a static module, it means that you are building it directly into Apache. Very few people do this anymore. Usually you build PHP as a DSO, it's called Dynamic Shared Object, that you load into your Apache with a load module configuration line in the Apache configuration file. You can build it into Apache. You go in, you go with Apache, give the source directory, the path to the source code for Apache, specify whatever other switches, make install, CD into the Apache directory, configure, activate module, and then you pass the source, or the path to this library that's going to get generated. It's important to understand that this library doesn't actually exist yet. A lot of people send in bug reports and saying, well, I saw the documentation said to do this, but it wasn't there, so I tried something else and it didn't work. Don't try to second-guess the damn documentation. There's a big note in the documentation. This is correct. This is what you should type. And it just works. Just do it that way. But it's really, some people say it's slightly faster having it built directly into Apache as a static library. I haven't been able to measure any speed differences there. The PHP INI file, I've talked about a few times now. You can set all kinds of things in that. Short open tag, for example, is whether you have just bracket question mark versus having to do the full bracket question mark PHP. ASP tags on and off, all kinds of stuff can be set in here. There's a section in here that loads extensions. So you see all these extension equals. by default, we had the Windows ones in here, so you can just comment a line in, on the Windows version. But it's the same thing in Unix. You put extension equals pdflib.so, for example, that'll load up the PDF extension. A bunch of other things set in here. Some MySQL specific stuff. In here, you can set the max number of connections and whether or not to allow persistent connections, things like that. So whenever someone says, hey, you need to change the configuration of PHP, PHP and INI file is the place to do it. In case you didn't know, you can always check the PHP INI file location by doing a PHP info. PHP info brings up a screen that looks like this. Right in that, in the beginning of it, it says configuration file, and it'll give you the path to that particular file. One little trick, if it doesn't show you the actual PHP INI, if it just says the path, that means it couldn't find it. It's looking for it in that directory, but it didn't find it. We need to make that a little bit more obvious. It's sort of a subtle thing. We need to put a big sort of flashing thing that says, this is where we're looking for it, but we didn't find it. PHP runs fine without its INI file. It just will go with all defaults. And it's generally a good idea to use a PHP INI file so you can fix the default, so you can upgrade PHP without things changing on you if we happen to decide to change the default. If you have an INI file where you fix your various settings, then an upgrade is not going to screw you up. There's all kinds of other information in here about all the extensions that are loaded and other stuff. Yes? No, there's nothing in PHP that stops you from running without an INI file. That's sort of on purpose, because most people don't have one. They really don't. Yeah, but I mean, then you're talking about them, you're talking about being able for them to change files or remove files from your system. Then they can just put a new version of PHP on there, a different version of Apache, anything they want, different kernel if you want. I mean, if you have people diddling around with your files, then you have much bigger problems. Yeah, that's probably true. That depends a little bit. By default, we don't install one at all. So it's whatever the various package maintainers out there have decided to do with the INI file. I'm not sure what Debian does with that. All right, where are we? We are over here. All right, some other configuration things. Error handler 404, we sort of looked at that this morning. We'll look at that later when it becomes really handy to redirect all requests to a 404 handler written in PHP. Other things you can do, you can force all the requests for a certain location, so slash products directly to PHP. You can force everything in a certain directory, so it doesn't matter what you name the files inside the directory, every single file in there would get served up as a PHP file. And we'll make use of this later on as well. Now, template systems. This always comes up. Personally, I have no use for template systems in PHP. PHP is a templating system as far as I'm concerned. But because of the way this particular templating system, PHP, has grown and added functionality, people now see, well, I need a template system on top of that because it's too powerful. There's too much stuff that people can do. I want to sort of expose a very simple system to my designers. I don't want them mucking around in PHP code. As far as I'm concerned, that can be done by just having policy and saying, look, you work on HTML, we have our PHP business logic in a different file, we expose some various functions, call these functions to do certain things. But people want to tie it down a little bit more, so there are various template systems out there. There's one called Template Power. Here we have a little example app that goes through and gets a username and a list of users, so the current username and a list of users, and it puts up a little form like this with a title plus the current user plus the list of users. So we're just sort of evaluating how that gets done in various template systems. In this template power system, you build your business logic where you populate these things and you then expose the various business logic functions to the template. So what you have in here is title gets exposed, user and users. Yeah, okay, so here, start block users. This is a loop type mechanism. I don't really know the syntax of these things, but some kind of looping construct that says loop over this users thing, put in option, and then the user, the actual value for each entry in that array of values, and then end that block. Most of them look something like this. Another very popular one is Smarty. This one's actually quite smart because it caches things and it converts the template plus the PHP code into just a single PHP file. So you're not reading the template on every request. It just checks if it wasn't modified. It uses this cached PHP version, and even the output from that PHP script can then get cached. So it's quite smart. And again, you take the various business logic things, you expose them into the template layer, where you then only have access to title, user, and users. And then the same thing in Smarty looks something like this, where you have title, you have some various little things that says you can capitalize things. So you have some logical level things. And then you have this looping construct as well. As far as I'm concerned, every template system will eventually evolve to become PHP, because people are going to want the extra business logic in there, right? The same thing that caused PHP to evolve the way it did is going to happen to everything. Then you need a third template system on top of that. All right, and then the same thing in PHP. I mean, in PHP, it does not look as pretty, I have to admit. It's not quite as pretty, but it solves the problem, and it's a hell of a lot faster than either of those two ones, where you have the business logic separated, and in here you then use to actually display the title. Yes, it's not as nice as curly braces, perhaps, but it's the same damn thing. You echo out the value of a variable, and you have a little looping construct that loops around and echoes out the users. If you don't want your designers to write a loop for loop, well, you give them a little access function that says print users, right? And they put that tag in. It says print the users at this point. To me, that works just as well. A new thing in PHP 4.3, which if there are any sort of serious PHP hackers in here, you'll appreciate this. There's a debug backtrace function in PHP 4.3. And here I've shown it as part of an error handler. You can sort of pick the code out of the PDF file I'm going to give you afterwards. But this is a custom error handler that you can set using set error handler. So whenever an error happens in PHP, the error function built into PHP will get called. You can replace that function with your own. So whenever an error happens, your function is going to get called with the error number, the string for the error, the file name that the error occurred in, and the line number within that file. So all that information gets passed to your error handler. You can then page yourself on your pager, on your phone, whatever, SMS yourself on your phone whenever you get a syntax error or something, or do whatever you want with these errors. One thing with debug backtrace, you can now put a debug backtrace call inside your error handler or anywhere else you want. And here I've just shown it in action. I have a little tiny function called test1, another one called test2. This is inside a separate file called file2.php, just to show having multiple levels of files and multiple levels of function calls. And I call this test2 function with 1, 0. Call test2 with 1, 0, so A is 1, B is 0. That calls the test1 function, so with 0, 1, and now we end up getting 1 divided by 0. I switched them back and forth. But what we end up with is a division by 0 right here in this particular one. When my error handler is called, this is the output I get. I get division by 0 and file2.php at line 3. Which is correct, lines 1, 2, 3. It's right there on line 3. Then you get the backtrace. This is when the debug backtrace comes in. So this is the normal error that you get from PHP, basically. But here, we go in and say, okay, my error handler was called. That's the first level of this is where we are. Then, a step below that, test 1 at line 3. This is where the actual thing happens, so we're still here. That test 1 was called by a function call that called test 1 with these particular arguments. Now we have the arguments to the function where the error occurred, and we know it was called from line 7 of file 2. So here's the function call that led up to the thing, and we know that test 2 was called from line 31 of file 1.php. This is line 31 of file 1.php here, and we see the arguments that led into that function call. And now we get a little bit more complex because this slide is running within my presentation system, which was also running in PHP. So now we actually see a little bit more information that, hey, this includes file 1.php happened at line 1220 in objects.php. So I have an object. All my slides are XML files that each of them have a display handler for the type of object that they have. And this is an example object called the example display handler. And you can see here that says, the HTML function that was called from display. Display goes in, checks the current display mode. It can either display in PDF or in fancy HTML or plain HTML. So this sort of goes all the way out into my presentation system as well and traces all the way back up to the top to show where that error happened. And that can be very useful for tracing back errors. It's only in 4.3 though, so you likely have to upgrade to get it. Yes? There is nothing special about writing an error handler. You just have to write whatever function you want that takes these arguments, right? You have four arguments. Yeah, no, you can have it in your standard include file. If all your files always include a certain file, you can put it in there. There's also something called a, what is it called, auto file, oh, I forget what the heck the thing is called. Yeah, auto prepend file, that's the name of it. But always prepends and runs a certain PHP script before your real script gets executed. So you could put it in auto prepend and it's completely transparent. So if you want your own error handler like that, usually your error handler you just need during debugging stages. We want some more information, or sometimes on the live server where you want things that you can't do via the standard syslog option. There's in PHP INI, you can redirect all errors to a file or to a syslog or something, and you can then trigger any kind of paging or SMSing that you need off of the syslog. You generally wouldn't do it via a PHP function because it slows things down a little bit. But then again, errors shouldn't happen that often, so it's not a big deal. You can run it in production as well. All right, a little bit on opcode caches. PHP, normal standard PHP looks like this. Script starts, we compile the script down to opcode. So we pass through the script twice. We go through, first time we go through all the tags, all the HTML, we reduce it down to a series of opcodes. The opcodes are basically sort of machine language of PHP, if you will. Then we go through the executor, we execute those opcodes. If, as we're executing, we get an include, we go and we include the file, we read the include file, we parse it, reduce it to opcodes, execute those opcodes. Function calls, generally they're already parsed, well they are always already parsed. We go through, we call the function, just execute the opcodes that are related to that particular function. Now, with an opcode cache tossed into the mix, generally they will cache the opcodes that it has parsed into memory, onto files, or mmap them somewhere. And we go through and first we check, do we actually have the cached version of this particular script? If we do have the cached opcodes, we skip the compilation step and go straight to the execute mode. So we execute the opcodes. For includes, we do the same thing. We do an include. Has the include file already been parsed? If it has, skip around, execute it. Otherwise, no. Pop through, compile it. Then at this point, store the included file that's been compiled now to opcodes. Store that in the opcode cache. And that's how the various accelerators out there work. The Zend accelerator, the IonCube one, various other ones. There are about five of them now. The main ones, APC is the one in the pair module that you can install. It's not quite as fast as the two other ones, IonCube and ZenCache. IonCube is free, but he hasn't given out source code to very many people anyway. I have the source code, but he's not quite sort of on board with the whole open source effort. It would be nice if he was. Hopefully, someone's going to fix up the APC one to be just as fast as the other two. It's not that hard to do. But then again, you don't gain all that much. It sounds like you would gain a whole lot. You don't usually gain that much unless you have a lot of include files or a lot of really complex object-oriented code. For small sort of top-to-bottom scripts, you really don't gain anything at all. They're very easy to install. Once you've compiled them, you get a shared library. Just in your PHP INI file, that Zend extension equals, then the name of it. This happens to be the IonCube one. You get this SO file. You can just go and download it for your platform. If you go to ioncube.com, it's a download list of all the different platforms. You download the shared library, stick it on your disk, send extension equals blah, and restart your web server, and it's there, and you don't have to really worry about it. Read the README. You can change where it stores its cache files and stuff, so there's a couple of little things you might have to configure in your INI file, but usually there's not much to do. Not that much to them. And then I always get asked, hey, why doesn't PHP just have one internally? We didn't worry about it initially. We sort of said, okay, here's where an opcode cache would plug in. We'll build that later. We just had the hooks for it and say, okay, next problem. We have many other things to worry about. And then the various open source projects came up with opcode caches that hooked into these hooks that we had provided. And we never sort of there was never really a motivation to say, well, okay, let's just pick one and then bundle it to PHP and piss off all the others. And we just left it and said, okay, fine. As long as there are free open source versions out there available and there are closed source ones, let them fight it out and do stuff. We don't really care. At some point, maybe, we'll sit down and do sort of the one true opcode cache for PHP. But right now, I'm quite fine with the current situation. It would piss a lot of people off if we actually did go with one, because there are some guys trying to make money off of this, and that's fine by me. Profiling PHP. This is a very useful thing. If you're doing lots of PHP hacking, it's very hard to figure out sometimes. Once you've gone through and looked at your slow queries, for example, you've gone through all kinds of stuff, you installed an opcode cache, things still look too slow. Often it's because you just have some really stupid code somewhere, or you're doing something really dumb, or you're doing a regular expression 10,000 times on the same piece of memory, or something really dumb. What you can do is run a profiler. There's one, the best one out there is called APD. It's now in pair, so it's this easy to install. You type pair install APD. That's it, and it installs it. It does a bunch of things. You'll see it installs it. It's there. You can do pair info APD. It'll give you some information about the APD that you installed. Do a config show. The only thing you might have to do is go in and just enable it, maybe copy it into your real PHP extension directory. We have this format of the extension directory where we put in whether it's a debug mode or non-debug mode, whether it's threaded or non-threaded. I like to keep my extensions just all in userlocal libphp and load them from there. So I tend to just copy the ones I use into userlocal libphp. So that's usually what I do when I install APD myself. So the first thing I do, either copy it or link it into my userlocal lib directory. userlocal.libphp, then in my PHP ini file, send extension equals userlocal.libphp apd.so, and set dumpter. The dumpter is where it's going to write its profiling files. What happens then is it's not completely transparent. You have to, in the script that you want to profile, at the top, put in apd set pprof trace. Once you put that function call in the file, and then hit that script a couple of times with your web browser, you can then run the command line tool that also gets installed called pprofp. You have a bunch of switches on it. Normally, I just do a minus Z on it. It says sort by user system time spent in subroutines. So in this case here, I've done one on the php.net main web page. I have a local mirror of that here. And I do a pprofp minus Z on that particular pprof file. You'll see them popping up in slash temp, do an ls minus lat or something to see the most recent one. Go in, run pprofp minus Z on that, and you get this kind of information back. So here you say, okay, 33% of the time was spent calling require once, which sort of makes sense. Require once requires in files and parses and executes those files. So that's expected that that's up there. FEOF, we have 183 calls to FEOF, take 22% of the time. That's maybe a problem area. That's because I have a loop that loops through a text file for the calendar parts of the PHPNet website and do a while not FEOF. I probably shouldn't do it that way. I should probably just rely on the return of the fgets or something returning minus one. Or we may even have a problem with FEOF being too slow. It's kind of weird that it's that slow. But the whole point of this is that this tells you where in your code and how much time and memory has been spent in various parts of your code. You'll see bits and pieces of it have negative memory usage. It's a little hard sometimes to figure out because sometimes when things go out of scope, we use less memory versus when you're allocating more memory. It gives you some indication of where things are actually using memory. fgetcsv is an fgets with comma-separated value parsing built into it. So there's quite a bit of gear in that function. It makes sense that it uses a bit of memory and it takes a bit of time. But it's a very handy thing just to sort of verify that where you think time is being spent in your script is actually where the time is being spent. Okay, what time is it? 4? Should we take a short break? Do we need a washroom break? DNA, yay? Okay. Back 10 after? All right. Should I slow it? Should I just... Let's get started again. We have about 20 minutes of understandable stuff, then I'm going to start losing you guys diving into the C extension API. So, first of all, a little rant on URLs. I really, really wish that URLs would be simpler, cleaner, predictable. I mean, you can go to a site, ibm.com/product/thinkpads, for example. IBM is not actually that bad. You can go to ibm.com/thinkpads and actually get something. But a lot of sites will just come back with a 404. If you try to guess the URL of the site, impossible. You have to sort of click your way through. And that annoys me a little bit. I don't see any reason why you can't make slightly smarter URL handling. Hold on. Yeah. All right, so the rant on URLs, it'd be very nice if URLs were predictable, they made sense, you actually did something useful with them. What I like to tell people is that what happens, for example, if you go into a store and you ask the clerk behind the counter for a product, but you get the name of it slightly wrong, or you say, can I have this thing over there, and she has to search around for it a little bit. If you get the name slightly wrong, it's not like she kicks you out of the store and says, get out of here. 404, not found, go away, never come back, right? It's nuts. We do that on the web, though. Yeah. Well, why not? Why not? Yes. Yeah, it definitely does. Not just your mindset, but him over there and her over there. Everyone's mind. It has to be able to figure out where people expect data to be. That's not very hard to do. It sounds hard, but I'll show you how to do it. So anyway, we start off with the first simple approach here, where a URL comes in, /product/routers. You might have used the force type trick that I showed you earlier. Anything inside force type, or anything here that says anything that starts with /products is all automatically going to be a PHP script. So actually this products file here, this is not a directory in my document root. It looks like it might be. You're so used to having a URL be a remote file name somewhere. URL is a universal resource locator, right? It's not called remote file name, right? It's not an RF or a URF or something. It's a universal resource locator. It's named a URL for a reason. It's not just a path to a file on a web server. It has nothing to do with a file. Yes, today most people map the URL directly to directory/filename.html. But that's crap. It doesn't need to be that. So in this case, what we have is we do a force type application x httpd. We have created a file on our server. So we, instead of making a directory called products, we have a file just named products. It has no extension on it. It's just called products. It's sitting in our document root. Because of this force type in our Apache configuration file, this will be treated as a PHP script. There's this handy thing called path info. Has been in the CGI specification since like 1960. Okay, maybe a little bit later than that. What happens is path info would get filled in with everything after this point where Apache stops. Because of the force type, Apache is going to read up to here in the URL and say, okay, I know this is a PHP script, execute the PHP script. Everything remaining in the URL gets stuck into path info. So our path info variable is going to contain dollar path info will contain /routers at this point. So you write a script, call it products, put in your document root, whatever people put in, products/whatever, you're going to get the /whatever in the dollar path info variable. You can then do a database search, select star from products, where description like path info. You might want to strip off the initial slash if you wanted to. But that's extremely useful. Now you suddenly have a website where you can go /products, then type any word you want. And automatically your script can take that word and do something intelligent with it. Yes? Yes, the manual stuff is done something like this. Not quite, it's actually a 404 handler, which we'll talk about now. So at the same level, instead of just forcing people to go to /products something, you can now just say, well, let's just put a 404 handler up. Any URL, any file that's not found on disk is going to revert back to the error handler. I have done websites that had no files whatsoever. All they had was an error handler. So the entire file, or the entire website, was served up by a single program acting as an error handler, looking at the actual request, saying, okay, he's asking for this URL. Okay, that means he wants this kind of information. So in your Apache configuration file, you can do error document 404 pointed to a PHP script. In your PHP script, you have access to various things. The redirect URL is usually what you want to deal with. You can also get the redirect status. You can redirect other error numbers, so you can redirect the 302, 401, whatever you want to a certain script, and you can check what sort of error got you there. Generally, you just redirect 404 and look at the redirect URL. In this case, it might have been doc root bogus, and you can look at that and then pick out pieces of this information and see whether or not this should be a valid request. That's how we do it on the php.net website. You go php.net/a function name, or if it's not a real function, we'll pass it off to the search engine. That's what we have. We have a redirect script there that goes through and looks at the URL that you asked for and then redirects you to the right place on the website. You can go much further than that, though. For those of you who are there this morning, I showed a way of caching images where we go through and we look at the image that was requested. If it's not there, we generate it and we put it in that spot. You can do the exact same thing with normal content. So here's the image cache from this morning. Go through and we define a 404 handler just for the images directory, and we go through, we look at the image, we pick it apart based on the underscores and the file name, and then we generate the image that's described in our file name. That's fine and dandy. It works great for images, but you can go further. You can go to what I call funky caching. We use a combination of sort of the concepts that we've seen so far. We have a generate.php script. 404 error handler gets called when Apache can't find the URL on the drive. We go in, we look at the actual URI that was passed in, and we pick it out, the redirect URI out of document root. We do a little bit of manipulation on it to get rid of the document root and stuff. So we have our URI that we're dealing with, the actual file path to a certain file underneath our document root. Then we look at that, and we have some logic that figures out what we should generate. We turn on output buffering, then we generate whatever. So we might look at the path and say, okay, this was a request for /ThinkPad/CPU/type or something. So, okay, this person has a ThinkPad, he's looking for a certain type of CPU in his particular model ThinkPad or something. You might do a database query, but it doesn't really matter what the business logic is. The fact is that you get a bunch of strings passed to you that you can then use to see, okay, he has this keyword, and this keyword. That probably means he wants some information about this. If he has those keywords in a different order, who cares? Because it's still just three keywords. You do the same database query, and you come up with some information. You do a database query, you do an LDAP query, you do whatever you want to generate the information that's associated with that particular URI. That URI has nothing to do with the file name on the disk. We will make it have something to do with it now. So we're going to start our output buffering, generate the content for this particular request based on the keywords that we picked out of the URI, generate the content, fetch it out of the buffer, then we write that content to that URI. Yeah, a little bit more logic in here so you don't overwrite the script and other things. So I want to make sure that you write in sane places. But the basic concept is that you look at the request, the URL that was requested. It wasn't there, so your 404 handler is called. Your 404 handler does something intelligent with this request, and then it writes that information there. So what you were saying up at the back before is, the web server has to know where everyone expects things to be. Yes, because we're going to write things where people are asking for it. So that same bit of information might mix up the keywords, /foo/bar/ding, right? I mean, next try comes in, looks for ding, bar, foo. It's still the same three keywords, probably the same information that they want. So we're going to store it in two places. Disk is cheap. It doesn't matter if you store the same content in 10 different places. Who cares? Disk is cheap, customers and users are hard to find, right? So the customer comes through the door and asks for a certain object by one name, another customer comes through the door and asks for the same object by another name. The clerk behind the counter knows the fact that, hey, he's actually referring to the same thing. Those are just two different names for the same thing. Reaches on the shelf, gives you the right thing, right? The website should be able to do the same thing. It should not be dependent on you having to type in the right bloody cryptic path to get to that particular thing. If you type it wrong, you get kicked out of the website. That makes no sense whatsoever. And I really, really hate websites that has a 404 page at all. 404, can't find it, go away. That's crap. You have to have a next step. Even if you don't know what to do with the URL, say, okay, we've popped it through our search engine, we've done various things, you might be looking for this, or that. But with this approach here, this actually generates a website that looks exactly like people expect it to be. And it's cached so that the next time through, so if someone puts up a link that happens to be wrong going into your website and a billion people from Slashdot end up hitting that link, they're actually going to get the right information because the first wrong hit in there is going to generate that content, and then every subsequent request is going to get a static page after this stuff has been generated. To flush your cache, to refresh your cache, just remove all your files. It's pretty easy. You might need a little bit of logic in there that says, okay, when I do insert something in my database, in this particular table, then this is the class of files that I want to delete. So you can add a little bit of business logic in there, but it's more the concept I'm trying to get across, that you don't have to relate URLs to static file names on the server. If you don't happen to match them up, everything breaks. Thank you. I have used this in a number of different places. There was a weather site that had weather reports streaming in. Every 4 hours, they got something like 7,400 weather stations reporting, and they generated a weather forecast for each of these stations based on that data that came in and based on previous data. They generated three images, sort of a three-day forecast, and a couple of other images and some pages for each one. And they had this script that would run for over 4 hours. They couldn't actually keep up, which is why they needed help. The more data came in, and they had scripts running on all this data, generating all these pages, and it made no sense because less than 1% of these various weather sites were checked by anybody. Nobody cares what the weather is like in Wisconsin, right? Everyone wants to know what it's like in New York City or San Francisco. So those sites get hit all the time. Wisconsin never gets checked. Why generate it? So this, the same concept I applied, say, okay, the stuff that gets hit often, we're going to generate every 4 hours, the database gets updated. So every 4 hours, I wipe out all the files on the web server and let my 404 handler regenerate them as they get asked for. So it works extremely well. People peeking at me. All right, another thing that works extremely well, we use this on the PHPNet website. We're using Squid as a reverse proxy. Those of you who have hit Squid before have probably encountered it as a forward proxy, meaning universities like this, companies, AOL, places like that. When you're logging in via the internet connection and try to hit various websites out there, you end up going through a proxy. So 5 minutes ago, somebody else has requested the same page. It's coming directly from the proxy, saving the university lots of bandwidth. That makes lots of sense, but you can turn this thing around and you can put the proxy in front of just one website. That means that a request comes in for a certain page on the website, and the way you set it up, the way I usually set it up, is I have Squid listening to my external port 80, and my Apache server is only listening to the loopback or the localhost interface on 127.0.0.1 port 80. So my Apache is not actually listening to outside connections at all. It's only Squid listening to real connections. The connection comes into Squid, says, I want this page, index.php. Fine, Squid says, I don't have it in my cache, passes the request on to Apache. Apache calls PHP that parses the index.php and generates it. My index.php has an expiry header in it, or a cache controller header that says, this page is valid for the next 30 seconds, like this. Think of a news site, for example, where stories flow in, even a really busy news site. Say you have a database full of news articles, and the front page takes two SQL queries, or maybe just one SQL query to generate it. Say, select the last five news stories, put them up on the front page. Now, even if you want this stuff to be really, really current, say you put it just down a 30-second expiry on this stuff, and say you get hit 100 times a second. That's not that much for a large site. I mean, I'm at Yahoo. We get hit a hell of a lot more than 100 times a second. A smaller site gets hit 100 times a second, takes one SQL query to generate the front page. If you put it behind a reverse proxy like Squid, and every 30 seconds you generate it, that means that for 30 seconds, Squid is going to serve up the cached page. It never touches my Apache, which means it never touches my PHP, which means the SQL query is not executed, which means that 100 times 30, so 3,000 SQL queries is reduced to one. Because for 30 seconds, we do one SQL query, cache the output, let Squid worry about it, and then 30 seconds later, we're going to get the next request trickling through because it has expired from Squid's cache at that point. We have now cut the load on our backend web or SQL server by 3,000. So instead of adding 3,000 new servers, we can just run everything on one by one little tiny process that we put in. You don't even have to run Squid on a separate box. You can just run it on the same box. We do that on the PHPNet website. We find we get about 70% cache hits. A cache hit we can serve up in about 3 milliseconds. A cache miss we serve up in about 240 milliseconds. So there's a huge speed difference. So sort of averaging the stuff together, we serve up a page in about 8 milliseconds on average. Some of them being really slow, most of them being really, really fast. It makes a massive difference, even on really, really short expiry times. even put it to a 5-second expiry for 5 seconds. So that goes from, instead of having 500 hits on your database, you now just have one every 5 seconds. It makes a huge difference, and it really is not a big impact. So what, people have to wait 5 seconds to see any new news story? That's not a big delay, and you get a huge benefit out of it. So that's one aspect of using Squid as a reverse proxy out in front of your web server. The other aspect I talked about earlier is having multiple instances of Apache running as different user IDs. Usually the problem with doing that is that you then have to run, you can only run one Apache instance for port 80. Other Apache instances have to run on different ports. Nobody wants a website that runs on port 81 because everyone has to type colon 81 after the URL. Nobody wants that. If you put it behind Squid, you can have Squid redirect requests. It can look at the virtual host and redirect it to the appropriate port. So the request is going to come in on port 80, but Squid looks at it and redirects it to the correct instance running on separate ports. That way, they all look like they're running on port 80, but they're actually completely separate instances running as their own user IDs. They can each be jailed, so they can't interfere with each other. And that's a very nice way of doing it. The only thing you have to watch out for in your PHP code is that inside your PHP script, instead of having remote address is a server variable that Apache sets that tells you which IP the request came from. When you're behind Squid, all requests are going to come from Squid. They're all going to come from 127.0.0.1. Squid does pass this information through, but this information is now in this HTTPX forwarded 4 variable. That's the only thing at the PHP script level you might have to change if you switch your site to sit behind a Squid reverse proxy. And most scripts don't use remote address at all, but you can do a quick grep and see if you use it and then switch that over in case you're behind Squid. Yes? No, I don't think. Well, maybe there's a double layer. There might be a XX forwarded 4. There might actually be. You might find an XX forwarded 4 that shows you the higher level up if the original request also came through one. Typically, public proxies will not send you an X forwarded 4 at all. AOL, for example, doesn't. You don't know which IP behind the AOL proxy it came from. But some do send them. You're right. I don't know for sure, but I'm pretty sure I've seen the XX in here. But check the Squid docs for that. So, just in case you're interested, and then the PDF file that'll be on the conference CD, you can see the actual configuration in the Squid configuration file that I use for something like this. Typically, you have to tell Squid, listen on my IP port 80, for example. CGI bin is dead, turn it off, don't need it. Ramp up the RAM a little bit, maximum object size perhaps, depending on how much RAM you have in your box. The real interesting stuff comes down at the bottom. We set the acceleration host, which is where you say, here's where my Apache that's going to be serving up my content lives. So 127.0.0.1 or wherever he decided he's going to live, port 80. And I used to turn on SMNP. I have a little PHP script that pokes my Squid server. If I had network access, I could show you. But it's a little PHP script that just via SMNP pokes my Squid server and tells me numbers of how long it takes to serve up requests and stuff. There's also a CGI bin program that comes with Squid that you can use that gives you the same information. Just sort of an information slide in case you're trying to do this yourself. Now, load balancing with Squid is another interesting piece where you put a single box with Squid on it and you have multiple web servers in behind the scenes. There are a couple of different ways of doing it. In the previous configuration here, remember we set our HTTP XL host here? This is for sort of a single server. We have Squid and Apache running on the same server, just a single box. When you go into load balancing mode, what you can do is have an etc host file that does a round robin DNS on that HTTP XL host. So you set it to the name of a host, and in your host file, you specify 5 IPs. Squid will then round robin across those 5 IPs automatically. It's smart that way. That's the very boneheaded, simple way of doing load balancing across multiple servers behind Squid. A more complex and much more intelligent way of doing it is to use the cache peer directive in Squid. Cache peer was actually originally written to have multiple Squid or multiple proxies talking to each other and communicating, but they do this communication over HTTP. And you can actually set up your web servers as if they were other proxy servers, and Squid will then act as the top-level proxy server that sends requests down the line to what it thinks are other proxy servers, but they're actually just real web servers. And it works quite well. And you do it something like this, basically. And it is a little bit faster. It also has ICP support. This thing here, the second argument here, is the ICP port to check. ICP is the Internet Cache Protocol. It's a little query it sends that says, hey, are you still alive? I haven't actually played too much with this, but one idea would be to set this to the echo port, turn on the echo port service, for example, so that the top-level SQUID server will notice the fact that one of the web servers has gone away and will not direct any requests to it. And stupid round robin, you have to go into etc host and get rid of that server also. Every fifth request or so is going to be dead. If you use ICP and the cache peer stuff, you can have the top-level SQUID server notice the fact that these things have gone away. For the redirection to various, you saw how I did redirected virtual host to certain ports and stuff. It's actually not very good to use a redirector. I didn't talk too much about it, but there are various things. There's a thing called SquidGuard, which is this Perl script that you plug into Squid that Squid calls out to do interesting things. It's really slow and buggy to do that. There are ways to do most of these things internally in the Squid configuration. And again, with the you can set up what's called access control lists within it. Say, okay, for certain domains, the actual destination domain is this, and then you can go through and say all requests for a certain domain is going to end up only on a certain server, and you can go through the Squid docs to figure that out. But just to keep in mind that, yes, SquidGuard looks really easy, and it is really easy to set up, but it's not the most efficient thing in the world. If you can get away from any kind of plugins where the cache has to call out to some kind of script language, it's really a bad idea. Script languages are great, but if you can avoid them, avoid them. So what we're sort of getting to, and one more little thing on load balancing, is you can also just throw some hardware and some money at it. You don't need to sit and fiddle with Squid. Generally, with a bit of fiddling, you can get Squid to do just about anything you want, but you can also just go out and buy a Cisco CSS box or Big IP or one of these guys that does all this for you. Or even LBS can do it. But what I want to get to is this. Basically, this final picture down here. This is sort of the optimal web server architecture, as far as I'm concerned, where you have a reverse proxy out in front, you have a bunch of web servers in the middle that you load balance across, and you have a database server at the very back. Now, I do another thing here that I talk about in this slide. I replicate my database, I replicate a local instance onto each of my web servers, so that all database reads are going to happen from a local instance of MySQL, all writes are going to happen to the central server. Obviously, this works best if your application is read-heavy. Most web apps are. Many more database reads than writes. And the way we do this, in MySQL is dead simple. Like most things in MySQL, it's really bloody simple. You can do it with other servers. Postgres is finally starting to get semi-decent replication. It's a little bit behind. There is some good commercial stuff from the Postgres Inc. guys. Not sure if they've open sourced it yet. I don't think they have. That's kind of annoying, I think. Anyway, in MySQL, what you do is go through on your master server, you go through and in the my.conf file, you turn on binary logging. Binary logging means to log everything that happens, basically, in this compact binary format. And you also give it a server ID. Each server in your replication architecture has to have a unique server ID. So make the master number one, for example. It doesn't need to be. You also have to create a user and say, okay, all my replicate servers are going to log in as REPL with password foobar, for example. Just so that you authenticate, you don't have rogue proxies or rogue servers logging in and grabbing your data, for example. So here, set up the username and the password. Now on each of your slave boxes, you first of all, you can turn up max connections a little bit, because this is going to take lots and lots of connections from localhost. It's never going to write, so each connection is going to be really fast, usually, so you can turn that up a little bit. Turn on binary logging. Technically, you don't need to log on the slave servers. I like to log on the slave servers because there's a way in MySQL to switch the slave and the master. So you can actually execute a MySQL query that says switch master, that switches to another IP, says this is now the master, and all the other slaves will see that and say, okay, we're now using that as the master for a while. So if all the slaves have a binary log, any one of the slaves at any one point can now start acting as the master. You can take your master server down, do some maintenance on it, bring it back up, switch everything back, and that way you can keep things up and take servers down at will. So, but this is a slave server, so we're also specified where to find the master. This is the IP, this is the user to log in as, and this is the password, the port, and this is server ID 2. Other ones would be 3 and 4. A couple of things you can do on the MySQL instance on that particular slave. Because this is a read-only one, you can skip some stuff on startup. You can do low-priority updates, because we're really never going to do any updates on this particular server, and delay key write for all tables. Those are just options that will make reads a little bit faster when we know we're not going to write to it. And that's what we end up with, this kind of combining our SQL stuff from earlier with the redirection rules, cache peer rules, to load balance across our different servers, have an Apache instance on each physical machine, have a replicated MySQL slave on each one, so that a request comes in, it usually will only touch this particular web server. Every now and then, that when you need to write, you end up writing to the master database. Your application has to be written such that the write and the read go to different MySQL connections, but that's pretty easy to do. You can have a read connection and a write connection. And this will scale almost indefinitely. You can put as many web servers as you want in the middle here and scale horizontally. You can put multiple SQL cache servers out in front. Your real bottleneck is going to be the number of writes to the back-end database server. And yes, that can be a bottleneck. You might have to split up the tables across different things. I have yet to see any kind of problem that couldn't get handled by an architecture, something like this. The delay, you mean the delay in terms of you write here until it gets out to all the slaves? It's almost instantaneous. I mean, it's not instantaneous. There's a few milliseconds in there, I guess, but I have never been able to write a PHP script that could read from the master something that wasn't on the slave in the time that it took to execute my PHP script. Impossible. Maybe with a very tight C function or something, you can do it. Well, obviously you can, but in the sort of the times that we're working with in PHP and the web serving, no. It's, as far as you're concerned, it's instantaneous. Yes? HTTPS doesn't come into play here. Do you mean the actual caching key stuff? And oh, I see what you mean. Okay, so when you mean when you have multiple virtual hosts and you want to do, okay. No, that's not as easy because when you're doing SSL, you really need a separate IP for each domain that has the thing. You're only doing one domain. When what's the problem then? Can you have SQL with the SSL? You can do SQL. Are you sure? I'm pretty sure that you can give SQL your SSL cert and that it can do that. Have you checked the latest version of SQL? Yes, SQL patch isn't true. I'm not sure. I'm sure I've run across a config that can do SSL through either sort of transparently through or via SQL. I don't quite remember how it was configured. Do a little bit of reading. I can't answer the question, though. Sorry. I'm pretty sure it can be done, though. Yeah? It's not... How would it cache reads?
What?
What happens is whenever you do a write, the write automatically gets replicated to all the slaves. Right. Right. Once you plug it back in, it's going to start catching up. That's true, of course, yes. If you disconnect this cable, but you leave this cable up, then yes, this slave is going to have old data for a little while. Your application will have to be able to handle that. Or you have something in it that says, if this connection is not there, stop accepting requests here, right? Stop the ICP service that says, this slave is ready to go and I should get requests. I mean, you might want to tie those two together. Generally, it's the actual machine that goes down, or it's the Apache that goes down and it goes away. But yes, you have to be aware of that, of course. Yes? You mean like session IDs and stuff? This is exactly the architecture that you need for having a central store for your session ID, because the request can come in on any of the different web servers, so you have your session set save handler that stores all your session data in the central database here, that gets replicated out to all the slave servers first request comes in, gets handled by this guy. The next click in this shopping cart application ends up on this server over here, for example, right? But the session data is all stored here. It gets replicated to all the servers, so all the session data ends up being local on all the web servers. Perfect, great. We don't have a problem. Yeah, but that's impossible. The replication in MySQL is so fast, there's no way that you can have a request come in on that server and then have the next request come in on the next server and beat MySQL's replication to that. No way. I've run MySQL replication up to 50 servers, and there's no way, even with 50 servers sitting there. And with something like this, with three, and I challenge everyone to have enough load to be able to overload just three servers in the middle there. There's just tons and tons of capacity. Maybe with NT or something slow in the middle there. But put Linux servers in there and you're rocking. Yes. I mean, that is one instance where you may not be able to replicate everything to all the different servers, because if you have a huge, huge, like Yahoo's user database with 350 million users, we don't want to replicate that database off to our, what we have, 4,500 different web servers, right? We don't want to replicate, I don't know how many gigs of information out. Yes, in that case, those ones you want to keep central, but you also want to limit the amount of queries that you have to some database that is that big. If you have 1,000 requests a second into a database that has 400 gigs, yeah, you have a big problem. You really do. But what you want to do is segment your data a little bit and see, okay, this is the kind of the data that's going to get hit a lot. We can narrow it down and say, okay, let's replicate this particular table to this group of web servers, maybe a different table to this one, and maybe do something intelligent up in your SQL redirection and say, okay, maybe have two levels of redirection. So this type of user, send them over here. They have this portion of the database. I mean, you have to come up with something interesting there. When you're dealing with that much data, you have to do it. Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, I can't tell you how to do all these things. There's so many things that you can do to optimize things. This is more a general purpose thing for places where you can actually replicate the data out to the different servers. This is a very, very good way to do it. And yeah, I do agree. For huge, huge databases, you can't do it this way. All right. Now we start getting really scary here. How much time do I have? I have 45 minutes, right? Yeah. 45 minutes to teach you how to code in C, basically. All right. So, three main reasons to sort of get into the guts of PHP and start hacking around, fixing bugs. Always a good thing to do. Most common thing is creating a PHP extension to talk to some kind of C library that's out there. Maybe a proprietary C library that you have within your company, some proprietary business logic that talks to your own back end, and you have a nice C or C++ library with a set of functions and a nice API. It's very easy to wrap that and make a PHP extension. Or other times you go through and you run the profiler that I talked about earlier, you go through and you identify the parts of a PHP script that's really bogging you down. It's not running fast enough. You see, hey, this block here, if I rewrote this bit in C, I could really speed up my application by a whole bunch. So that's sort of the third way. Not enough people do that yet because they're not familiar enough with the... I mean, people choose PHP because they don't know how to program in C and other things. But many also choose it because it's just much quicker to get stuff done in C or in PHP. And falling back to C is sort of... why bother? I'm going with PHP. Why fall back to C? But the combination is extremely powerful. That's what we use at Yahoo. Most of our stuff is written in C or C++. PHP is used as a templating system on top of that. And we have now, we've only started recently, we have about 30 different extensions to talk to various back-end things in Yahoo. And it works very, very well like that. And I wish more people would use it that way. And the various criticisms PHP gets for being slow and dirty and stuff, yeah, if you write huge, complex applications all in PHP, it can get very slow and it can get very dirty, as can any language. If you pick and choose your battles correctly and write the really heavy-duty stuff in C or C++, link it in, I challenge any language out there to be faster than PHP and a web app. And that's why Yahoo went with it. I mean, Yahoo is huge, and they need to handle a lot of load. And by using PHP in this way, they can get there. So this is sort of the picture of PHP when it's embedded inside the web server process. This would be your entire Apache process. We had the web server layer at the top. And the sizes of the boxes here are actually somewhat accurate in terms of the amount of code, at least the web server layer. Apache is actually much smaller than PHP. So it's kind of weird that we embed PHP inside Apache, you know, elephant through the keyhole type thing. But PHP attached to it looks something like this. We have a SAPI layer. This is our server abstraction API. It's a standard set of hooks that if you write a SAPI layer for a particular web server, you can plug PHP into any web server that you want. We have the PHP core stuff, built-in functions on the PHP API. We have a TSRM, Thread Safe Resource Manager layer that just handles thread safety. And we have the Zend engine at the bottom that has the compiler that compiles things to opcodes like we talked about, and the executor that takes those opcodes and executes them, actually executes the script. And that has an API leading into it as well. And most of these things are sort of modular and pluggable. This is the layer we're going to talk about here. It's the extension API and the extensions that you can plug into PHP that talk to the various bits and pieces, talk to Zen, talks to PHP, and sometimes talks directly to SAPI and TSRM as well. And it's easier than you would think. Hopefully by the end of this, at least a couple of you will be able to write an extension. So first thing to do, grab a copy of current PHP 4 CVS code, because you really want to work with the current code. No real point in writing for old versions of PHP. Generally, the current API will work with older versions, versus older versions of PHP is not necessarily going to work with newer ones. We're backward compatible, not always forward compatible. The general structure of PHP source code, you have a send directory, a TSRM directory, main, all the main PHP code is in here, and then inside ext are all the extensions. And there are tons of extensions that come with PHP, so you have tons of example code. Everything in PHP is an extension, basically. You can go in and look at, if you want to write a database extension, talk to your own proprietary database, have a look at some of the existing ones, MySQL, Postgres, Oracle, whatever, and pop in and check out some of the extensions that look similar to what you're doing. If you're writing a SAPI extension, i.e. adding support for PHP to some new web server, you can go in and look in the SAPI directory. We have tons of different ones in there. Go in here. Oops, I was talking about SAPI, wasn't I? So you look in here, we have all kinds of stuff, ActiveScript, AOL Server, Apache, Apache 2, Cadium, CGI, all kinds of different ones. We even have a Tux one, and the in-kernel one on Linux. We do run in user space, though, for Tux, luckily. You don't want my code in your kernel. That would be horrendous. All right, so the first thing, you have the current source tree. Blah, blah, blah. This is more how you actually grab the source tree, sorry. Read the various files in there. readme.extscale is a good one. A little bit about self-contained extensions and maybe the parameter parsing API, a couple of good readmes that come with the PHP source code. In the manual, you'll find in the appendix of the PHP manual online, there's an extending chapter that has some good information. There are a couple of books out there with somewhat decent stuff. The one I wrote has a chapter on extending PHP, which has most of the stuff that I'm going to show you right now, but explained a little bit better. It's the Programming PHP book from O'Reilly, and I really don't care if you buy it. So please don't accuse me of plugging my book. I get like 10 cents per book or something. It's ridiculous. All right, so I also usually test with the command line version of PHP. It's a little bit easier to plug it through GDB. There's less overhead. So I generally build myself a command line parser. Just configure make install by default will build the command line version of PHP. You can plug in a couple of extra extensions if you want to make sure that it works with other things as well. But then run it from the command line. It'll get installed in user local bin PHP by default. Run it minus V to give you the current version. We can do it here just to make sure I have one as well. So I have a 4.3.1 installed on here. And now you're ready to go. First thing generally I do when I'm writing a new extension for PHP, I write myself a little sample PHP script where I write the PHP script that shows how I want to use my extension. So here's one I wrote a while ago. It's an XMMS extension. XMMS, as you probably all know, is an MP3 player for Linux. This is a little extension that controls the player. So I can put a web interface up, and I had a little machine connected to my stereo. I had a web interface where I can go and start and stop the stereo and the songs I wanted to play and stuff. All in a little PHP script. So write up a little sample of how you want to use the thing. That's a nice way of sort of getting your mind set. And like, okay, I'm going to need these types of functions, and the functions need to take these arguments and return this kind of stuff. Once you've done that, write yourself a definition file. You don't have to, but it makes things a little bit easier. Where you basically just put in and say, okay, mostly it's a prototype. So the function will return an integer. The name of the function is xmmsstart. It doesn't take any arguments, void. And you can put in a little one-line documentation thing. What this does is we have a script that generates a skeleton extension. And it will read through the function definitions, and it will give you stubs for all the functions. So a lot of the really tedious stuff of setting up functions and stuff all gets done by the script for you. So if you make yourself a definition file, half your job is already done once you've run your script. So in the ext directory of the source tree, you will find this ext scale script. You pass it a couple of things. You pass it the name of the extension and the definition, the function definition file, where you've defined all your function prototypes. And it goes through and it generates a sample extension or a skeleton extension with a couple of files in it. You have a C file, you have a header file, you have a makefile.in, which gets generated once you run all the comp stuff on it, and a config.m4, which is an automate thing. So once you've done that, there are then a couple of things to figure out. Whether you want to have it part of your PHP source directory, at the very top level of the PHP source tree, oops, if you go up to the top level, you will see there's a build comp script. Build comp runs through and generates the configure script by looking at all the extensions that are there. You can also work completely separate. And when you do completely separate, you can basically move the stuff out of your ext directory in case you let it run build comp. You don't want it to pick it up. So you can move that directory somewhere else and work on it as a completely standalone directory. To turn a standalone directory into something that you can compile, you run phpis. And you will find many C extensions that you download from places. The first thing they tell you to do is run phpis. That basically does the autoconf automake magic that creates a configure file, so you can just do configure make to build your extension. Okay, so far we haven't really programmed anything yet. We've just played around with configuration files and run a couple of scripts. And we have a little bit more of that to do. I mean, if you are relying on external libraries, you have to have a look at your config.m4 file. It's written in M4. It's really hassle to deal with, but it's the best way we have. And you go in there and you specify which libraries you're dependent on. There are a whole bunch of comments that you can go through. And then you do configure make. You can copy your file that you created. It will get created in the modules directory. You'll get an xmms.so in my case. You can copy into user local libphp, and then either in your php ini file, say extension equals xmms.so, or right in your script, you can do a dl xmms.so, and you should now have your functions that you defined available. And it will generate a little test script, test php script that just has a little congratulations message in it that everything worked. So it's a good thing, before you even sort of start programming anything, just try and compile, configure and compile your module without any of your code in it, just to make sure that all the gear, the compiler, the autoconf, automake, everything is working nicely. At least that way you know, hey, this thing compiled. Before I started mucking it up myself, it compiled. Right? Then you can always go back to the state where it compiled as you start. All right. So if we go through and look at the C file that gets generated, it has a structure of things that happen in there. First off, we include all the standard stuff. You'll see a bunch of includes at the top. We'll have a function entry array that goes through and defines all the functions that are available in this particular one. I didn't list all the ones. We do actually, when we have a definition file with a whole bunch of function prototypes, we put all those into the function array to begin with. Here's one, if you didn't provide a definition file, we'll just put the confirm compiled message in there, which is a little congratulations message. In our case, we would actually have a lot more listed in that one. We also have a module entry. The module entry array lists the various functions that are going to get called. The important one is the module init, which gets called when you start up Apache. It goes through and calls the module init function for all the different extensions that you have built into PHP. So if you have stuff that needs to happen when you start up, you do it there. things like dealing with configuration directives and doing certain things. Module shutdown gets called when Apache shuts back down, any sort of cleanup. Request init and request shutdown are called on every single request. You want to limit what you do in those. Ideally, you don't want to have a rinit or shutdown. Ideally, you just set that to null. But if there is something you need to do on every single request, then put it in there, same with the request shutdown. And finally, there's a module info. Remember the PHP info page, this one? Every module has a function that gets called the module info function. So here, for example, the SWF extension just has a single one that says enabled. That's the default thing. You can put various other information into these things. Some of the ones have a whole bunch of information, but that all happens in the module info function. So, if you have any sort of INI entries in the PHP INI file, there's this macro called PHP INI begin, PHP INI end, where you can define them. There are comments in there. You can just sort of follow and copy from other extensions. Module init function, all the various functions basically have macros, so you don't have to worry about how you define the functions. Just do PHP init function, the name of your module that you're doing, and you can do various things. Register INI entries is a common thing you do in the module init. And on the module shutdown, unregister INI entries is a common thing that you do. Rinit, rshutdown, they all have to return success if things were good. So return success after each of them. If something does fail on the module startup, for example, if you return failure here, then Apache will not start up. You can print out an error message and say, can't start for whatever reason. Otherwise, return success. Okay, so you have those functions. You have a module info function that has some prints to print out stuff. And finally, you have this little sample function at the bottom, which is the built-in one that just prints out, congratulations, you've successfully modified blah, 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 and compiled everything, and everything works. So that's the default skeleton extension that you get. Now, to actually start coding this stuff, the first thing you really have to understand is that we have this union where everything lives. So things are very loosely typed in PHP, but internally we keep track of whether a value is a long, meaning an integer, every integer in PHP is a long, a double, a string. Because we're binary safe, every string is stored as both the string data and the length of the string, so strings can contain nulls in the middle of them. Hash table, these are arrays basically, or an object, these are objects in PHP. Now, setVal struct, every value then has a reference count, whether it's a reference to begin with, the actual value, and the type. So this is the CVAL struct type that you see. You don't have to worry too much about it. They're both called ZVAL or PVAL. It's the same thing. Some people prefer PVAL because it's PHP we're building for. So a PHP extension will use PVAL. A Zend extension that goes into the gut to the engine and does stuff will tend to use ZVAL. But they're interchangeable. They are exactly the same thing. And you'll see them all over the code differently. You have a whole bunch of convenience macros that dereferences these structs. So picking out the LVAL, for example, instead of going through and dereferencing it, we have just some shortcuts that goes and picks them all out. They're handy to use. If it happens to be a pointer, then you can put underscore P. If it's a double pointer, underscore PP to dereference the double pointer version of it. So you'll see those all over the code as well. Macros are all capitals. Now, the first thing you're going to have to do and figure out is the parsing parameters bit of it. So when you write a PHP function, the first thing that you do is you take parameters that get passed in for the PHP script. You call the function with some parameters from the PHP script. Your C-level function has to take those parameters and do something interesting with them. There's a send num arg that just returns the number of arguments. So this is sort of the simplest little function you might be able to do. One that just takes any number of arguments. It doesn't care if it takes 1 or 10. It just returns the number of arguments passed to it. So that's what this function would do. Here's a little one that says that if we get something more than one argument, then return an error that says, hey, you passed me too many arguments. Not really useful. There's a helper function in PHP called zenParseParameters, where you pass in a string that contains the actual types of variable or types of arguments that you take. In this case, we take a single integer. L means just a single long. If it's optional, you can put a little pipe symbol in front of it that says this optionally takes a long. So you can either pass it with 0 or with 1 arguments in that case. And you specify the long here, long arg, int argc, just the number of arguments, and just pass a reference to it, and it will fill in the long with the value that got passed in. These are the different types you can pass to send parse parameters: long, double, string, boolean, resource, array, any object, specific object, probably won't go into too much detail in that, or mixed. So there are certain functions that can take either an array or a long or a string, and based on what type gets passed in, it does different things. So here, for example, is a little function that takes a whole bunch of different arguments. So it takes a string, a long, an array, and then optionally it also takes a resource. So that's how you just string them all together, make sure you have the actual variables in your function, and you fill in the appropriate variable names and at the resource level as well here. We'll build an extension here in a second. So, let's see, which one should we build? This next one, I think. Yeah, okay. Talk a little bit about array parameters first. You can pass in an array, the array type. What you end up doing is you can then, PHP has an internal array pointer that points to the current element of the array, and you can move that pointer along using next and prev and for each, and the various functions will move the array pointer along. So the one thing you have to remember is that you pass an array into a function, the array pointer might be somewhere in the middle of the function. So when you do a get current data, it might not be the first element. So what you might have to do is you have to reset the pointer to the beginning of the array, then loop through the array to do things with it. Other times you want it to start at the current element. So that's the only slight trick of dealing with arrays. We have a bunch of different hash functions that go through and resets, get current data, move forward, move backwards within the array. It's basically a linked list. But once we've dealt with arguments, the next step we have to deal with is returning information back to the user, back to user space PHP. It's a whole bunch of macros that help us with that. The simplest one is sort of like return true. Just says return true, this succeeded, or return string is another simple one that you do. Return string, you pass back and says, here's the string that you asked for. I have some simple examples down here. My sum, this one takes two longs, so it takes two integers, it simply adds them together and returns the result. So return long arg1 plus arg2. We have set up long arg1, log arg2. We're calling send parse parameters, telling it here comes two longs. Please put them in here, in arg1 and arg2. And finally, we just return the sum of the two. That's all there really is to that. Yes? Yeah, in this particular function, which is the one that you need the most, there's a readme right in the source directory. Remember I said read a couple of ones? One of them is the parameter parsing API. That has, because this is the one people ask about all the time, so we stuck the documentation right in the source code for that particular one. Other functions, you will find documentation either in the online manual, php.net/manual, or search around a little bit, or maybe pick up a book that might have it, but it's not as well documented as the rest of PHP, definitely. The best documentation is really all the example extensions that you have. Go into any of them and just grab for the function and see how it's used. That's how I do it. I don't remember all this stuff either. Okay, here's another example. It's a my upper. It goes through and it uppercases every other character in a string. So you pass in the string, every other character gets uppercased and return the result back. It's pretty useless, but let's build an extension that just does this, start to finish. Of course, this is a little bit scary doing live coding in front of things, but the first thing we needed to do is we had to have a definition file. So let's just do this really quickly. So this is going to return a string. We'll call it my upper. And it's going to take a string, right? And it's going to uppercase every other character. Why doesn't that look right? Yeah. Okay, so we have a definition file. Now we can call extscale. And its extension name, we're going to call it upper. Oops. And we have our protos. Oh, I forget if it's protos or proto. So you can run it. We have a little usage thing on here. Oops. Oh, I have to be there. So it's minus proto. Okay. extscale minus minus extname equals upper minus minus proto equals upper.def. Bang. Oh, did I see an error? I'll put up def, no such. Oh, I put it in the wrong place, didn't I? Yeah. Am I root? Yes. Let's get rid of this upper that we generated without the right thing. And now we have the upper.def in the right place. Okay, I don't think there were any errors that time. No. So now we have the skeleton extension. I can now cd into upper. We have a couple of things in here. The first thing I can have a quick look at is the config m4. Generally, if you're not relying on any other libraries, it's pretty easy. You can just turn on the enable and get rid of that, get rid of that. Okay, I guess it's easier for me because I know, but read through the comments, and it should be pretty much straightforward. If you just rely on a single third-party library that you need to link in, or if you don't have any, then it's really easy. You don't really need to do anything in here. And PHPIs, that should generate a nice configure script for us. And also generates all kinds of other files. Okay. Now we have a whole bunch of files in here. We'll have a look at our upper.c. Oops. Upper.c that was generated for us. Okay, so this is it. It's my font's a little big. I guess I could get, who cares. So all we really need to do is plug in the function and have a look at our various things in here. That's not needed. We'll close that fold back down. It also has the built-in Emacs Vim folds in there, as you can see. So I can open and close my folds and look through a big file pretty quickly. Where's our function list? Here we go, functions. So here we can see that it put in an entry for my upper because we had it in our def file. We also have our confirm upper compiled. We can get rid of that. We don't care about that one. We can go have a look at the module entry that tells us the various functions that we're going to get called. We're not going to need a request init function in this module, so we can set that to null. Not going to need a request shutdown. We'll set that to null as well. So that can really kill the performance of your server on every single request. If you have an rinit, it's now going to make a function call to that particular extension. By default, we have a little stub in here that just does return success. So it doesn't do anything, but it's next to function call. It's a very good idea to get rid of them. So get rid of our init, our shutdown. Somewhere in here there's the confirm compile. Get rid of that. Blah, blah, blah. Some comments. Get rid of that. Now, here's our my upper. This is the stub that it put in for our my upper function. So we told it that it took a string and it returned the string. But that basically just puts in a little warning that my upper has not been implemented yet. We can go back to our slide and we can just copy our thing. Up to here it should be right, I think. Well, I should have the P and the I in there as well, I guess. So grab that code, we'll just plug it right in. Get rid of the not implemented warning, plug it right in. VI. And I put it in the wrong place too, didn't I? This bit has to be up here. Cut and paste programming. Parse parameters, we already have that line. The return, we already have. This is the business logic of our function that loops through the string, picks out every other character, does something with it, and returns the result. We're missing the name of the variable. We called it string. So put the argument into string, string length, char pointer string, string, P and I think that's all we need, right? So we're going to get a string into our function. It's going to get put into string. The length of the string ends up in string length. We loop through, starting at the beginning, every other character. We uppercase it. We return the final string length. Done. That should be fine. Okay. Now, configure, enable upper. Blah, 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 bit of configure stuff. It'll be a miracle if it just works. All right, hey, it configured. Hey, it compiled without warnings, that's cool. Compiled, ship it, you're right. Now we have an upper.so, modules.so, so upper.so, I can copy that into my extension directory, which is user local lib. Typing in front of people is hard. Okay, so now we have upper.so and our user local libphp. We can have a look at our php ini file. PHP ini file, we have an extension block here that has all our extensions. I have the ming extension as a separate module. We can just do extension equals upper.so. All right. Restart our web server. Restart it. Now our first little test, we can go over in our info and just see if the module info function that was in there actually worked. Because there's a little stub info function in there. And hey, look at that. Upper is now registered here, upper support enabled. That's just the standard one that ext scale added for us. Now we can go and test it, go into our document root, which happens to be here. Upper.php, it's a new file, and what was it? It was echo my upper, if I pass in something like, say, linux.conf.au. Right? So it should uppercase every other letter of this particular string and show us that if it all worked, or it'll sec fault and nothing will work. upper.php. Ooh. So. All right, so I don't know how long that took me, but in about 2 minutes anyway. Yes, I know what I'm doing. I can run ext scale and stuff, but it's not that hard. It's not that bad to build a skeleton extension and just sort of follow along and fill in the bits of code that are missing in there. It's not as hard as people will say, and it's not as hard as my explanation of it makes it seem. It really is easy. All right, so a few more things. Once you get beyond building just the standard extension where you can take parameters, you can do stuff to the parameters, you can return the result, you want to do a few more things probably. You want to return more complex types. We have this built-in magic variable called the return value. Whatever you put in the return value is what's going to get returned. You don't actually have to put a return in there yourself. What those return macros do is they assign things to return value and the function just ends. We don't actually really return anything. To return an array, you can call array init on the return value. That will make the return value an array. And then you can add things. Add index string L, for example. You just keep adding things in there, the values that you want to put in, and that will return an array from that particular function. So call array init, and you can call various things. We have add index long, add index null, add index bool. We go through, and depending on the type of the index and the value that you're putting in, you call these various things. There's also an add next. Remember our syntax in PHP where we can just push to the end of an array by putting like a non-indexed version of the thing? The C API equivalent of that is the add next. We don't have to provide the actual index. You just pass in the zval where you're adding it, and then the value in this case. I'm just adding a bunch of integers to my array. So just pass in the longs that I want. If it's a null, I'm just sort of skipping past it, really. Bool, same thing. So there's some very easy functions to use there. You can add associative indices. These ones so far have been with integer indices, so unsigned the index value, but if you have a string index, you call the add a soc long, add a soc whatever. So here's a little example of returning a two-dimensional array. Basically, all you have to do is you array init the return value to be an array, and then each value that you put in, you can array init that, and then add values to that. So you just add an array on top of an array, and that returns a two-dimensional array. I know I'm going fast, but I have 9 minutes remaining, so. Object factories, that gets really complex. Not too many people need to write extensions that create objects, but it's not that bad. You have this class pointer, and you basically go through and define the various methods that belong to that object. And you have some helper functions, again, where you go through and you do object init. Instead of doing array init, you do object init that says this return value is now an object. And you can then add properties to that particular object. So if you add a bunch of properties to it, this is much, much faster than building a big object in PHP and instantiating it there. Smarty has that problem where it's has a huge base object. I ended up optimizing that and rewriting that bit in C, so I would just instantiate the base object in C, because it's not that hard to do. Array init, or object init, and then add the various properties. This runs so much faster than doing it in PHP. If all you're doing is just instantiating the base object and then doing other things with it later from PHP, it's fine. It'll still give you much more performance. Methods get added by this, where do I have the method? So I have the next slide, I think. Oh, I don't see it. I guess it's just my function entry here. Yeah, okay. Here are my methods that can get added for it. You end up, as if they're just normal functions, you can associate those functions directly with the object. In the init function here, you go through and say, this is the array that contains the set of functions that belongs to this particular class. So a little bit harder, but it's not that bad. And it's very easy to write a procedural and object-oriented API for something because the function, the methods themselves can sort of be called inside or outside, like they're static method calls within the object. I know I didn't explain that very well, but have a look through the PDF that you get on your conference CD, and it makes a little bit more sense. Note that when you're dealing with properties, just like in PHP world, when you're dealing with a property inside a class, you have to use $this to dereference it. You have the same thing in the CIPI. You have this magical this pointer that you can use to add things directly to properties or modify properties within the current class. You can also access properties from the method by doing a set hash find on this pointer to actually pick out a certain property that might have been set either within the C API or even from user space PHP. If user space PHP, they have added a property to your class, you can access it directly. Other stuff, global variables. You can't really have global variables in your extensions because this has to be thread safe. So we have this wrapper that's handled by the TSRM module, the thread safe resource manager. When you're not building PHP thread safe, which you generally don't, for Apache 1.3, you don't build in thread safe support, all this stuff just becomes no ops, and they are actually globals, and we handle them as globals fine, but we have to do it using this syntax, because then in cases where you do want the stuff to be thread safe on Windows or on some web servers, where it needs to be thread safe, it's all handled for you. And you put in these macros, you'll see these all over the place. You'll see SG and other macros, which are server globals. You can do your own globals within your extension by putting your own access macro that in case we're in thread safe mode, ZTS specifies we're thread safe, then it's going to grab the stuff out of the structure and it's going to pass these structures around within your extension. It happens pretty much transparently to you as long as you use this approach. If you have globals, you can initialize the global values in your init globals function, which is going to get called when you start up, because in the minit function, you're going to put in a send init module globals. That's going to end up calling the init globals function, and all your globals are going to get initialized when you start up your server. You might, in your rinit, you might have some globals that you want to initialize in every request. You would put that in the rinit hook then. Finally, almost finally, SAPI globals. You might want to access some of the global variables from the rest of the server. So we have some server globals that contain useful info, server context, request info, SAPI headers, various other things, current MIME type, the char set, post max size options. Various things are in this SAPI global structure. Have a look in the code to find the actual structure. To access something inside the SAPI globals, we have this SG macro. If there's a structure inside SG, you can then dereference that further, of course. There are executor globals. The main ones you want to pick out of that are the current symbol table and the active symbol table. When you're in the global scope, the active symbol table and the current symbol table is the same thing because you're in one context. If you're inside a function, the local symbol table may not be the same as the active symbol table. But you can use this, it's just a hash, so you can use this send hash find to pick out variables. So you can write C code that looks at the current symbol table. So if you have written some PHP code that created some variables, you can write C functions that manipulates the symbol table, does stuff with it, and gets triggered by that. It's probably not a good idea. You really should make it logical so you pass stuff in instead of magically picking stuff out of the symbol table. We really try to sort of discourage that. If you want to use a variable, make your function so you pass it in the variable that you want to do stuff to, but you can sort of skip around that and just muck around in the symbol tables on your own if you want to. PHP INI entries, you can write an extension that does stuff with PHP INI entries. We have a PHP INI begin and INI end hook. You will see all this stuff commented out in the ext scale generated script that you get, a program that you get. You call register knee entries and then in the module globals or in the minit function. After you register your module globals, then you can call register INI entries. And the shutdown, unregister them, And then the minfo, we have a magical hook in there that just puts all your INI info up in the table. You saw that in my PHP info thing back here. You see these nice tables that get generated. Go. For the MySQL, for this is a good one here. It has all these different ones. Nobody has sat down to write all this fancy HTML directly in C. We just have a macro that picks out all the MySQL PHP INI directives and puts the values up for us. So that's what that function call does, or this macro. Memory management. We have these emalloc, an e-free. Basically, the standard C memory management stuff with an E in front of it are the PHP-specific ones that provide a safety net that makes sure nothing can leak. You will get leak warnings. If you don't e-free something that you emalloc, you will get a warning in your error log, in the Apache error log, wherever you have redirected the error log to. You will see memory leak warnings. They don't actually leak. We do go in and clean up, but we do encourage you to go through and write stuff that does not leak within our safety net, even though it doesn't actually leak. It's very hard to write code that will leak memory if you use the built-in memory management functions. Of course, if you call into third-party libraries that end up mallocing stuff and not freeing it, then yes, you're in trouble. You have to sort of free stuff that you malloc yourself. We can't save you from that. 2 minutes left. Resources. Resources are things like open database connections, files, other things. It can be anything you want, really. You can define a structure, you can store stuff in this structure, and you can pass a resource handle around. So you can call a function that returns a resource handle number 27, for example. You can pass that into another function and get the resource handle number 27, and you can use that resource handle number and go and look up that particular structure. It's very useful for all kinds of things where you don't want to pass a bunch of information back and forth. You just want to maintain some stuff within a library and just pass a handle back and forth. So that handle specifies this instance of data within your library. And you will see all kinds of examples of using resources all over the place in PHP. You can register the structures for a resource. In the case of FOpen, for example, the structure for FOpen is close. Right? So we close files that are open. When PHP shuts down, the destructor for all the resources are called. So that way you can do your own thing. If you have something that opens up a connection to a back-end server, make it a resource, register a destructor for that resource, that will get called when PHP and Apache shut down. Or at the end of a request as well, it will get called. All right. Don't have time to go through that too much. I think I have lost just about everybody by now. So with 1 minute left, let me go through a little bit of what we're working on for PHP 5. The big thing is the new send engine, yet another well, it's not really a rewrite this time. It's more just a change of how some things are done. The biggest change is the way references to objects are handled. Currently, like the rest of PHP, if you pass an object into a function, you're going to pass a copy of that object in. So if you make changes to a property of that object, it's only going to get changed in the copy. This sort of goes against everything you do in Java and other things, where if you're passing objects around, by default, they turn into references to the object. In PHP, we really didn't do that. We said, well, let's be consistent. Let's just, if you want to pass a reference to the object, pass a reference to the object. You can do that. But there's really not a whole lot of point in passing a copy of an object around. It doesn't make much sense, and it confuses a whole bunch of people that when you do $A equals $B, if $B is an object, then $A becomes a copy of the object instead of a reference to the object. To me, it makes perfect sense. And so to the rest of PHP, it makes sense, but people do get confused over that. So that's going to get changed in PHP 5, where $A in that case will then be the same object as $B. And if you change $A foo, the property foo inside $A, that also changes the foo property in $B. It will make things a little bit easier on the object-oriented folks. To me, it's not as consistent, and I thought it was a very good idea to make it the same, but peer pressure. Other things, aggregation, redesign of the API versioning. A lot of this stuff, we don't really have someone to do it and a decent time frame on it yet, so the PHP 5 release date is a little bit murky at the moment. Thread safety issue, responsibility on here. Right? It's a hard problem. I've talked a little bit about it. I mean, making sure all third-party libraries that we can link into PHP are thread safe. I don't know how to do that. We'd like to do it, so it's on our to-do, but it's probably not going to happen. There's no way we can do all of them. We might be able to do some. It'd be very nice if we do some. Some changes to the SAPI stuff. Input filtering is one I've been playing with recently to try to get rid of the cross-site scripting problems. I did this for Yahoo recently, on the plane here, actually. I was supposed to get it done before I left for Australia, but I never quite got around to it. But so on the plane here, I hacked up this input filtering system for PHP and for Yahoo so that all data coming from the user would automatically get stripped of any kind of HTML or JavaScript tags. So that the cross-site scripting problem is basically you have a form, you accept some data, and you display that data back to the user. If that data contains JavaScript and other things, then that JavaScript is going to run within from your server, and whatever security policies and things have been set up, that basically you're then running someone else's code. It can't really affect your site too much, but they can do things like steal the user's cookies, for example. If the user sends a cookie to your domain, and on your domain then you cause some JavaScript to get run that can then manipulate that cookie and show it or redirect things somewhere else, you can steal someone's cookie, a session cookie, you can steal various other things from the client that way. And it's really a big problem that not enough people understand. And I'm hoping that in PHP 5 I can get this input filtering that I wrote for Yahoo, get that into PHP by default so that we can turn on various input filtering rules and we can automatically strip out all this stuff and then provide an API function that says, if you really want the raw data from this particular variable, here's a function you call. And I also want hooks so people can put their own security policy in. And yes, by default, we're probably not going to turn it on, but just the fact that we have the hook and we document and explain the heck out of it and say, look, to be really secure, you really should filter all data coming from the user, get rid of any kind of HTML, make really damn sure that you know what you're doing if you're going to display the stuff raw back that they sent you. Yahoo has been hacked many times that way. We have 650 developers, and there's tons and tons of code. And in most cases, the obvious places they do check it, but every now and then there's a case where they miss it. And the zip code field, for example, where someone forgot to strip it. So people put JavaScript in their zip code, and then you go to that person's page that displays their zip code, and suddenly they can steal your cookies through that. I mean, it's a bit of a nasty thing that not enough people understand. So that's what I'm working on that. Also some other stuff, but RPC abstraction, some OO extensions to do interesting things. Georg and Zach had said they wanted to rewrite the MySQL extension. Personally, I don't think that they're going to do that. They just don't have the time and the energy to do it, so I don't think that's going to happen. We're not going to wait for them anyway. Whole bunch of XML work still to be done, a new test suite, better regression testing. That's been on our to-do since PHP version 2. On every version, we say, okay, we're going to put a new test suite in the next version of PHP, but it's still this script that I wrote ages and ages ago for PHP version 1 that keeps just getting tweaked a little bit, and then we launch it in the next version of PHP. And I predict that's going to happen again. Derek has said he'll do it, but I don't know about it. Another one we won't wait for. But that sort of gives you an idea of what the things are that we're thinking about and playing with. PHP version 5. Beta maybe in 6 months of some of this stuff, depending on how many things we drop from this list. If Spider-Man shows up, maybe sooner. I don't know. Okay, I'm 5 minutes over. Thank you very much for sitting through that. That was painful.